It's time for TWiT, This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Seth Weintraub, the guy who started 9 to 5 Mac. He's currently publisher at Electric. He's going to join Greg Farrow of Packet Pushers. He's always great for a quote. And Larry Magid from CBS News Radio. Lots to talk about, including a preview of what Apple might announce tomorrow at WWDC. The end of trending topics at Facebook. And autonomous vehicles, the future of driving. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 669, recorded Sunday, June 3rd, 2018. 15 minutes of fun. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. You can save $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit and using the code TWIT at checkout. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/twit. And by Moogsoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Visit Moogsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. It's time for TWiT, This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Each week we put together an illustrious panel of journalists and tech experts. And I venture to say you're going to like this week's panel. It's going to be a lot of fun. Larry Magid is here from CBS News Radio, connectsafely.org. It's great to see you again, Larry.
Always good to see you, Leo.
Welcome. Getting ready for WWDC. You'll be going tomorrow.
Yep. Going tomorrow morning. You know, it seems like an annual. It is an annual ritual, so why not?
I could tell you somebody who is not invited, besides me. And we welcome him for the first time to TWiT, but I've been wanting to get this guy for a long time. Seth Weintraub is here. Seth, you're probably known as the publisher of Electric, which is the electric.com is the magazine about electric vehicles. He's founded, created 9 to 5 Mac, 9 to 5 Google. And you said you have a new one, Seth.
Yeah, we have a new site called DroneDJ.com.
So great to have you here. I've been a fan from a distance for a long, long time. And we met a year ago at Google I.O., and I've been meaning ever since to get you on the show, so I'm so glad you could
And Seth rivals me as one of your few guests with a professional microphone.
He looks good, doesn't he?
Mic. Yeah. What kind of mic is that?
It's a Rode Podcaster.
Oh, see? Okay. But it looks like an RE20.
Looks nice.
Do you do an electric podcast?
Yeah, we do every Friday at like 4:30, 5 o'clock.
Nice. I have so many questions about electric vehicles, and we actually were talking before the show, but I'm sure there'll be more to talk about as the show progresses. Also, where are you located, Seth? Are you in the West Coast?
No, I'm actually in New York City, a little bit north in Westchester.
Okay, so it's evening where you are, but it's late at night where this guy is. Greg Farrow joins us from the Packet Pushers Network. He is a network wizard and always fun on the show, and thank you for staying up late for us. He's pulling the muff off his professional Rode Podcaster.
Yes. Wow. Three professional microphones. Yes. On the show. Yes. That's a record.
Love that.
I thought I'll leave it off. I won't put it back on.
Yeah, you don't need it.
I have an old-fashioned analog Rode, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? Three Rodes and a Heil.
It's hooked up to a USB adapter, but it's analog to begin with.
Sounds like a
Rode is an Australian company. Is it not?
Yes,
I believe so.
Oh. Yes. They do it all out of Melbourne, I think.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yep.
Yeah, the Rode Podcaster was one of the very first really good microphones that you could use, USB microphones you could use as a podcast.
Yeah, I use Rode for everything. I use it for the when I do YouTube, I'm using the Rode Video Micro Pro, which goes on the back and runs off my iPhone. And that's how I do all of my YouTube. I used to have this massive camera rig recording in 4K, and I've ended up just plugging my iPhone into a hand rig. And that's all I ever use.
Yeah, I love. I have a Rode stereo mic for my my Canon.
With
a big dead cat on it, and I'm not saying that because I don't like cats, although I don't. But
so I just use a.
There it is. That's a big puffy muff.
Yeah, I have a Glyph, and this is my Rode little roadie video thing, and then just click the camera in and plug it in, and that's how I do YouTube.
Awesome.
Have I ever showed you the microphone that CBS issued me for field work?
Oh, this I gotta see.
Yeah, nothing great. So
this is from the Tiffany Network.
This mic, if you look at it really closely, you probably can't see it. It says Mutual. So CBS acquired Mutual like a million years ago. Right?
So that mic is literally from the 60s.
It is. So I plugged this guy into it, the little Shure.
Is that a Shure? It looks like a Shure SM58.
Well, now it's a USB, right? So this is a USB.
Oh, yeah, you got the icicle on it.
So when this mic rolled off the assembly line, USB wasn't even a pipe dream.
That's got an XLR. But take off the muff because I want to see what the top of it is.
Oh, gosh.
I could tell you what it is from the...
Yeah, you probably know this.
That's an SM58. Sure is.
No. This is the SM58. This is an Electro Voice.
It's an EV.
35A.
Yeah, they made one very similar.
The SM58 is bigger.
Yeah.
This is a real. This mic is like the mic for field.
I think Edward R. Murrow used that mic.
This particular mic. He actually could have. That would not have been impossible for him to have used this one.
So just in case you ever wanted to know how little voice has changed in 40 years, you've just witnessed it right there, the XLR jack.
Yeah.
There's nothing new in voice technology.
Nothing's changed. So WWDC is tomorrow, the Worldwide Developers Conference. And I hope you don't mind, Seth, if I invoke Mark Gurman.
No. We're still good friends.
Great guy. Of course, cut his teeth. He was like 15 when you hired him at 9 to 5 Mac.
I think so. Maybe even younger.
He was a kid. And he was 22 2 years ago when Bloomberg stole him away from you. And he's done a good job over there. He's kept all of his contacts. And he said something quite surprising on Friday. I can't tell you because I don't pay for Bloomberg. They've put themselves behind a ridiculous $35 a month paywall.
Oh, my God.
But he says, his sources tell him, Apple will not unveil any new hardware tomorrow. And I have to give, first of all, it's Gurman. So it's, his sources are impeccable and he's rarely wrong. But also, this close to the event, I have to think this is a leak from Apple trying to dampen expectations. Because if people didn't know that, the expectation's been high that there will at least be new MacBooks, possibly new iPads, maybe even a new iPhone SE. And if they hadn't told people that ahead of time, there'd be a lot of disappointment tomorrow.
I think that Robert Mueller leaked it, actually. That's what Trump said.
Nothing comes out of Robert Mueller's office. This we know. So, Seth, do you think that's credible?
Well, I don't think Apple leaked it.
Really? Not to Gurman. If Apple leaked it, it'd be the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, you know how it works.
Yep.
So clearly, there might be, they could announce something's coming way down the road or something, but there's not going to be any, it doesn't sound like there's going to be any new hardware at WWDC. There's a lot of stuff that's in the pipe, like there has to be some new Macs coming soon. Everything's kind of long in the tooth there. We know about the SE too, or
whatever. I'm not sure about that. Do you really think that there's actually going to be some new Macs? Like Intel hasn't got any new CPUs. There'll be no new
wait a
CPUs
minute. No,
from
wait
Intel
a minute.
This year.
This was the exciting. This was the thing I was waiting for. I was waiting for a MacBook Pro with one of these new 6-core Intel processors, an i9 and Optane. Mm-hmm. I think that actually is some pretty compelling hardware, which just came out.
Intel announced it and then said it won't be shipping until mid-2019 this week.
What? The i9 won't come out? No Optane. What?
No Optane and no Canon Lakes. Nothing will ship till mid-2000. Like, they'll release sampling quantities. I was reading an article about they're releasing like 100,000 or something, and then all the makers will share a small number, so there'll be something that ships, and Intel will meet the promise that something will ship in 2018. But there'll be no volume CPUs, so there's a fair chance that Apple won't commit to a small production run, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What do you think, Seth? You're the expert in this field.
Apple hasn't been very aggressive in their Mac world anything lately. I feel like...
Ever. It was always the case that... maybe there was a time when Intel would have a new processor, and then shortly after that, Apple would have new Macs, yeah. But that has not been the case for some time.
My MacBook Air is almost like that, microphone that I showed you. I mean, it's getting crazy.
Oh, I could beat you. My Mac Pro is from 2013.
Yeah, you beat me on that one. Well, but the MacBook Air that I have doesn't look any different than the one that came out, 2010? When did they first ship that?
The truth is, because I hate these new Mac keyboards so much, this butterfly key is awful.
Yeah.
I bought when the 2016 new MacBook Pros with the touch bar and the butterfly key came out. I bought one immediately. I hated the touch bar so much. I would hit the Siri would start up randomly. So because I would hit it and I thought, well, if I've got a touch bar, I can't disable it. So I just said, okay, I'm going to trade this in for the one without the touch bar. But the keyboard was still bad. So I went back to the 2015 MacBook Pro, which is frankly the last decent MacBook.
Mm. It's hard to disagree with that. There's a lot of people who don't like the keyboard and a lot more people who don't like the touch bar.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Apple still sells. They still sell this 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro. That tells me there's a reason. That tells me
there's
a market for
that. Yeah, well,
I imagine those do pretty well, too.
I bet they must, or why would Apple keep them in the fold? It's still a Haswell processor.
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. One is Skylake was the 2015 CPU, and that was the last MacBook that Apple released that had that, and that was the major CPU release. Right. Since then, in 2016, we've had the Intel server CPUs, so we've had Kaby Lake was the successor to Skylake, which was really the TOC, not the tech.
It's been TOC.
And then you had Cannon Lake in 2017 and Coffee Lake, which was meant to, but they sort of hadn't shipped in volume. So their die shrinks. So Skylake was a 14 nanometer. Cannon Lake is a shrink of Skylake to 10 nanometers. So less power, more on the die. It gets a little bit faster. Then there's Coffee Lake, which was meant to be a 14 nanometer processor. I'm reading from Wikipedia here, and because I can't memorize all this, just in case you think I'm looking smart. And then there's supposed to be a thing coming, which is called Ice Lake, which is the successor to Cannon Lake. And it was supposed to come out at the end of 2017. Then they said 2018, and now it's 2019.
Saying is there's no reason for Apple to upgrade.
Well, there's no CPU. Updates. I think you know how we keep hearing all about this ARM CPU thing that people keep going on about.
Yeah, that Apple is going to be switching away from Intel and switch to ARM for all of its stuff.
I imagine that, you know, if Intel keeps upsetting the supply chain here, which is exactly what they're doing, I imagine if I was Apple, I'd be sitting there saying to myself, if Intel can't ship these desktop CPUs, whatever the reason might be, whether it's difficult to shrink the die, or where they can't get the production runs, or nobody's buying desktops, or, you know, whatever the mechanics are, Apple might actually start looking at the PA Semi team and saying, you know, can we boost this ARM CPU and turn so they can turn away from Intel as a supplier? Because every time they go public with the Intel CPU, you know, saying we've got MacBooks in the pipe, or they start to sort of feel people out to see if there's any interest for a new frame, Intel fails to ship. Now, I agree with you.
I'm shocked. This is bad news. I thought the i9 was imminent.
No, it's open-end.
What I was hoping was that tomorrow we'd see new MacBooks with new Intel processors and perhaps in a concession to the class action lawsuits, a somewhat improved keyboard. And then when Mark said, "Well, no, there's not going to be new hardware," I credited him. I thought, "Well, it's Mark Gurman; it must be true." So I started looking at Lenovo, but they don't have the i9s, and they won't, I guess, until next year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they talked about the Ice Lake chips in August. Then they announced them. And then remember, of course, they talked about Optane. We were talking about Optane 18 months in 2016. I came and I was on the show with you.
That was the cross point. That was the new cross point memory technology. Yep.
And they became Optane.
HP just shipped a new laptop, and I actually have it, but I don't know what processor it has. I haven't cranked it open
yet. It'll be Kaby Lake or Coffee Lake, right?
They've got some beautiful laptops.
I think, also, let's not forget Spectre and Meltdown and even the chips that you're getting from Intel today are vulnerable to these, you know, issues. And there's, to my knowledge, still three Spectre flaws that have not yet been disclosed. The newest one was disclosed and presumably patched, but there's three more we don't know about. I mean, this is just bad news,
So
you can see why Apple might – I do credit you, Greg, with one thing. You could see why Apple might say, screw it. And by the way, these aren't even really ARM chips. These are Apple A chips that are licensed ARM architecture, but they do a lot of customization.
They've done a lot of stuff. Mostly what they've done is refocus the die. So a lot of the ARM cores are the same, and they do a lot of optimization, so especially around the memory buses, if I remember rightly, and also to get more of them on the die. Anyway, lots of tricks and things that you can do, but fundamentally it's a base ARM architecture. At the best, they can tweak it at the edges and integrate the fastest bus architectures to the GPUs that they put in them and all that sort of stuff. So that's fine, but I keep in mind that Apple only wants to make one notebook, unlike HPE and Dell, who will happily make 10,000 of one notebook or 20,000 of one notebook and then ship it with a custom SKU just so that Best Buy has a unique one. You know, that fiddle that, when you go to the shop to buy fridges and they say, we'll have the cheapest price on this fridge anywhere. And that's because they're the only one with that model number because it's a unique model number to them. That's why you can't shop them, right? And so this is what HPE and Dell do in the retail channels, and they do with enterprise as well. They'll produce 10,000 of this and 20,000 of that and 50,000 of this. Apple won't do that. Apple wants to do one run. It wants to do, you know, 1 million units or 2 million units over a life cycle. They'll take one chip like they've done with the Skylake from 2015 or the Kaby Lake and just keep running it out the door. And every now and then you get a bump, but they don't futz around with, you know, breaking up their production schedules to be able to accommodate a new chip and a new controller and a new memory. And I suspect my sense of this, and this is just me, my gut feel, I'm not on the inside so like Seth is that Apple's come up with several designs based on Intel's commitments to them about the production. Intel hasn't been able to deliver, and so they've just pulled out. But because Apple doesn't communicate with its audience, it doesn't share what it's doing. Yeah, it doesn't give people
insight. We have no idea.
We know nothing.
But the question I have to ask is who really cares? Aside from, you know, the people who are designing rocket ships and, you know, the geeks, does the average person really need or care whether they have a 2013 or 2016 processor in their laptop? I mean, how many people really complain that their processor is too slow on their PC? I don't hear that.
I know a lot
much.
Of video professionals kind of.
Yeah, there's a niche. There are niches.
Photographers, videographers, rocket ship designers. But that's who buys, but I hate to say it, but that's who buys Macs. Coders too. Coders are very sensitive to compile times. If you had a 6-core processor and you had a threaded compiler, that makes a huge difference. And so that cycle, that, you know, write, compile, build, run cycle, the faster that goes, the better they are. So there are – what it is it's the people Apple should be and has traditionally cultivated, which is the professional market. It doesn't seem like they're doing much for the professional market. I have that iMac Pro, and to your point exactly, Larry, for 90% of what I do, it's no faster than my 2015 MacBook Pro because you have to have software that's tuned to use – I have 10 cores, nine of which do nothing.
I even edit video, so I turned my 1-minute podcast every day into a video, and I don't even remember. I've got an i5 processor on this.
Short videos, right?
They're short. It takes seconds to render. Yeah. I suppose if they were long videos, it would
trust
take longer,
me. If you're doing, I got the GoPro Fusion 360 camera. It takes 8 hours to render that video on a 10-core iMac Pro.
Yes, that's right.
There are things you do, and people do, a lot of people do, pros do, that do need that power.
It's more than just the CPU, though. Stop focusing on the engine and start thinking about the gearbox and the suspension. The new generation of Intels will support faster SSD buses. Hopefully we'll see some NVMe, maybe.
Does Optane make a difference?
Optane, I think, is a big difference, and I think from Apple – if you think about this idea of 3D NAND replacing memory and SSDs or acting as a cache in the architecture, should drive power consumption way down, in my opinion. And so instead
that's another,
of having a
that's
10
another
hour,
spec that's very important, power consumption.
Right. Yeah,
so
Apple
it's
likes
not the
that.
Yeah. It's not the CPUs, although the extra performance would be good. There's also a whole bunch of modernization around how the CPU interfaces to the rest of the equipment. So SSDs, Optane memory, new DIMMs, new DIMM architectures that are more power efficient using smaller processors so they consume less power. And it's all of that stuff which is actually what we don't need the CPU, but if you can get data in and out of the CPU faster or get deeper L3 buffers or whatever the current generation of features are in Ice Lake, then that's actually going to drive your experience. Everything feels snappier even though you're still running at the same clock speed, and that's what we want. We want that better hardware.
You've given me some hope because I really felt like Apple
has abandoned the Pro market. But what may well be the fact is Apple knows that, well, when we can get an Optane system and when we can get maybe a 6-core processor, this will be a Pro system worthy of calling a Mac Pro. That's why that's not going to be available till next year.
And well, look at how popular external GPUs are with the enthusiast market. Everybody's getting a Mac, iMac, and they're hanging off.
Right.
And there's any number of YouTube articles of people hanging these external GPUs to get the features that
because
they want.
Because they have such anemic GPUs in the current crop.
And what's in the processor, the GPU is built onto the CPU die, right? Or they're using a generation of GPU from 5 years ago, then the bus speed between the CPU and the GPU is too slow. That's why we want the new generation of CPUs that Intel hasn't delivered and isn't going to. So that's why I don't think we'll see hardware. If Apple, and I think it's too early for Apple to do ARMs, but I'm perfectly confident that Apple's sitting there in front of Intel saying, getting 6 months closer to an ARM CPU, better get your finger out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zach, does that
there's other things that they could update as well. Like, you know, we saw recently a new Huawei laptop with a kind of edge-to-edge screen.
Isn't that a gorgeous laptop? That what is it, the Honor?
It is. I'm not sold on the camera coming out of the keyboard thing, but everything else looked pretty good. And then, you know, as you said, oh, yeah, the Mate.
Yeah.
And then the, so the ports on MacBook, they could add, you know, like micro SD slot or, you know, God forbid, a USB-A port or, you know, there's a lot of things they can do. I don't think that's going to happen, but I feel like there's a lot of things they can do to get a new laptop out before mid-next year.
If all they do is fuck with the keyboard and a few slots and an edge-to-edge screen, people are going to howl.
Yep.
People are just going to whine and say, why is this not fun? Like the chief nerds, you know, the loudmouths, the people like us who, you know, think we're just all going to say, why did they even bother? So they're screwed either way they go. Because they're not willing to be open and say, this is what we're doing, this is where we're heading, if they could just stand up and say, this is the problem with bringing out a new laptop and be honest about it, instead of trying to come out with the trash can, you know, Mac Pro type mistakes that they've made.
And I wonder if they'll ever come out with a touchscreen Mac.
No.
I mean, that's something that
I think they've been very unequivocal in saying no. Do you agree, Seth?
I think the touchscreen Mac will be a iOS device that has a keyboard.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think the Mac line will ever go there.
Yeah.
No.
This is the new Mate. Look how thin it is. And I mean,
it looks exactly like a MacBook. So why can't Apple make that screen?
It's a great question.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the power? What's the battery life on that guy?
You don't ask questions like that, Larry. You just plunk down the credit card.
Yeah.
What's the battery life? What the hell you care about that?
Show the camera.
All I care about. Tomorrow when I'm at the WWDC and it's 3 hours into it and there's no power outlet, I'm going to care about the battery life.
Yeah. Let me see. Where does it come out of the? Come out of this. Let me see if I can find it.
Comes
picture.
Like out of the F6 key or something crazy.
It's so silly. It's so thin. But the connectivity, you know, connectors does have a regular USB slot, which is interesting, as well as two Type C's.
It can be done.
i7 processor. It's the 8550U. That's not a bad processor at the top of the line. Discrete graphics card available if you wish. 57.4 watt-hour battery. That's a big
12
battery.
Hours of video. That is impressive. That's impressive.
That's a big battery.
Now the only other question I can't afford to ask is how much it costs.
This oh there's the camera. There it is. Hello.
Man.
Hello.
Oh, that's weird.
Hello.
So the bottom of your neck is going to be the star of your videos. Yeah. Now.
Wow.
That's a non-starter.
Are you wearing gold chains? That's all I see. It's a guy with a man bun. So what does he care, right? He's a very assertive guy with a man bun, actually. He's just pointing that stylus like he means it. They all have man buns. What the hell's going on with the hair here?
You're going to end up with this. There's a thing going on social media at the moment of bearded men looking straight up, and then they're taking photos of themselves. It's the most disturbing thing. I put a link into the
chat room.
What's
under that beard?
Yeah. No, they look... Put the heads right back, and then take a photo of themselves from around their Adam's apple. It's pretty funny.
This is interesting, but that's a problem with a 91% screen. There's nowhere to put the camera. HP put it kind of right at the bottom. Remember on the left there.
I love the name MateBook. That's an awfully kind of like MacBook, but not really.
Full size backlit chiclet keyboard. At least they say it's a chiclet. They admit it. It does look.
So will the federal government let us buy these because they're made in China? Probably
Chinese not.
Company?
It's Huawei. It does actually look a lot. Oh, it's got a fingerprint reader. It does look a lot like a MacBook, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Too bad it has to run Windows.
Well, they all run the same chips.
Right.
They all have to look the same at the end of the day because they all run the same chips. They all run the same processors. They all run the same screens. The only innovation that Apple got when they did their first generation was that they used aluminium for the body, where everybody else was still making plastic so that they could rip customers off by giving them a cheap, shoddy product. And Apple sort of said, no. If we gave them an aluminium case, we could do something better. And then, of course, people realized that, you know, actually aluminium cases were a good idea. And Apple had made the market because the challenge was with aluminium was how do you mill it? And there wasn't anybody with machines that let you mill aluminium. It was much cheaper. In fact, you could only extrude plastic to make the case that you want. And so Apple gets out there, starts buying up these aluminium milling machines, and lo and behold, aluminium cases become standard. So that's the iteration there.
Pricing is good on this, by the way. The MateBook X Pro i5 with 8 gigs of RAM and 256 gig SSD
is good.
$1,200 and out of stock. Somebody in the chat room saying that this is not a Chinese company. It's from Taiwan. So that
really?
That's okay.
Huawei?
Yeah. I thought they were Chinese, but I guess not.
I'm surprised. That surprises me.
By the way, you got to love the tagline for this. The best laptop you've never heard of.
I'm pretty sure that Huawei is a Chinese company.
That's what I thought, too.
We've had people from our team go to China to attend their conferences. I think they may have an office in Taiwan and maybe even their head office. They may be raising capital out of Taiwan, but I'm not fairly confident they're not. I mean, just check their website.
Well, they say they operate in 170 countries and serve more than a third of humanity. They made the 6. That's right. They made the Nexus 6P. I forgot about that. I'm trying to find their.
I have a broken Huawei phone right here. It's actually an Honor, but I think Huawei makes the Honor.
Yeah, I think
it's made in China.
I feel like recently AT&T and Verizon didn't sell Huawei phones because the government, the U.S. government, kind of convinced them behind the scenes not to. So right. I feel like that's kind
right.
of China.
That's right. They were all set to get into AT&T and Verizon, and then the plug was pulled.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah. It's headquartered in Shenzhen, Guangdong.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. So that's why I should never listen to the chat room.
No, I think he's like, there's a lot of stuff that comes out of Taiwan. It's very difficult to pick the difference between. I always have to go and look these things up. But it's very much a Chinese arm of the government. As somebody's saying in the chat room, Huawei was founded by a former engineer from the PLA, the Chinese arm.
Chinese
That's
army.
Okay. Everything that comes out of Israel's ex-armed forces, so don't get too panicked.
So WWDC tomorrow will be really – it's funny. I was looking back at last year. They announced the HomePod, shipped it like almost a year later. They announced AirPlay 2, shipped it almost exactly a year later, last week. They announced iCloud Messages, Apple Messages and iCloud, shipped that last week. And the iMac Pro. They did have some hardware. They had the iMac Pro. Did they do the iPad Pro 10.5? Maybe not. But the iMac Pro they shipped there. So they did announce some hardware. Didn't get a lot of it out for a long time.
Yeah, they've been known to announce hardware at WWDC. A lot of times you'll hear people say, it's a developers conference. It should be software only. But they've throughout their history, they've released tons of hardware at WWDC.
Not even so specifically necessarily developer hardware. It's... When this is a bully pulpit. A lot of people are paying attention. Why not use this to announce something?
So. Yeah, and the March event wasn't that exciting. It was mostly education. So, So, it's already been half a year now, and Apple hasn't released anything. It's been more like 8 months since the last iPhone announcement.
You know, my audience mostly cares when they do the iPhone announcement. That's when people get excited.
Yes.
When the iPhone comes out.
It's because your audience is 100 years old, Larry.
My audience is at least 100. They all use a microphone. I should
No, I'm so, just teasing. So your audience is normal people, is the point.
They're normal
what
people.
Could they announce in hardware that would actually move the needle? Like, the difference between the iPhone this year to last year is about 5% better. You know, arguably the performance is a bit better, but I don't think people notice. The effect of face recognition is, you know, The camera, you know, the multiple cameras, everybody's got that now. You know, if they come out with the – there's an article here from Mac Rumors talking about triple lens cameras. You know, like, again, good to have, nice to have.
I will
I'm
say
gonna buy a phone, but I'm not going to really get one.
That was sourced from an analyst who seemed like he was guessing. It was a Chinese Chinese report, and it was saying something like, you know, if you read the Chinese part of it, it was like things that could happen, but we have no idea, and so we didn't run with that particular story.
I think Apple's doubling down on software driven photography. They're saying that if I use smart, like the portrait mode in the iPhone 8 that I have, is just extraordinary. But that's not a lens. That's not me changing from a, you know, 50mm nifty 50 to a 24mm lens or something like that. That's just put the phone up and the software does some processing and boom, I've got a portrait mode. I think we're going to see much more in the software, much less improvement on the hardware. Where do they go? What do they do? Put a bigger, faster CPU in with a better GPU and more memory? I mean,
I think they have the same problem with the software. It's hard. We're at such peak phone at this point. It's hard to think of what you would do to make the software significant.
I mean, it's sort of like, look at Microsoft, which, you know, until recently was only a software company. They go from Office X to Office XY. And I, you know, I'm a heavy Office user, and I can barely tell the difference between the current version, the version that came out 12, 15 years ago.
We're kind of at that point now.
You know, you just get to a point where it's so close to perfect. Or
you,
at least
you guys, you know? Seth, you guys at 9 to 5 Mac had, actually, Stephen Trouton Smith posted it, and then you guys posted the video, which Apple immediately...
Yeah, even at Streamable, which is like, you know, the NBA can't get stuff down from Streamable.
Pulled it down, baby.
Pulled it down pretty quick, too, like at like 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, fortunately, there were some screenshots, and it looks like the big feature, which Apple will announce tomorrow for macOS 10.14, you guys maybe thought it might be Mojave because there seems to be dunes on the screen in the background, macOS 10 Mojave. The big feature will be dark mode.
You know, the people love the dark mode.
Yeah, but really, how much programming time does it take to do dark mode? I believe that's a bit. I'm thinking it's just a bit.
All colors.
You got to do all the colors new.
Yeah.
And Apple News will be on the desktop now. That's
on the Mac
desktop. Yeah, that's nothing to jump up and down about at all.
What about augmented reality? Personally, augmented reality to me is a bit of a yawn. It's going to be like 3D TVs. I think it's going to be like a decade before that comes anywhere. But do you think Apple's going to try and do a song and dance around AR and then pretend that it actually matters?
I think they will try to do a song and dance around AR. I think that's kind of what they're focusing on right now. You know, we've seen like, you know, where you point your camera around, even at Google I/O last month, Google demonstrated a bunch of cool stuff.
They added AR to Maps, which is actually a useful feature.
Very useful.
Yeah.
So I think Apple's not going to cede the lead in AR. And there was that Reuters report about, you know, end-to-end AR stuff where you're sharing an AR screen with somebody else and it's not bouncing off any servers. So, I mean, I think there's some room to improve there. There's some room to be creative and show some really cool stuff. I don't think, I don't think Apple's going to cede that AR lead they have to Google anytime soon.
No.
And that may even affect their hardware in the short term with the
But to me, the big question is AR going to be a headset player that's going to be something that just is augmented with the screens of whatever flat device you're carrying in your pocket or in your backpack? I mean, I just came back from AWE, which is Augmented World Expo. And I saw a lot of products that did not require a headset. They just ran off of phones and tablets.
In a way, that's really what Apple did a year ago at WWDC. They announced ARKit, and they showed a lot of apps with it. And ironically, it didn't use the fancy array facing you that would have made a much better AR tool set. They used just a regular camera on the back. Google, which had a very fancy, elaborate hardware-based AR platform called Tango, took one look at the success Apple had with this kind of bogus AR kit, because it, you know, stuff doesn't quite sit on the surface. I mean, it's okay, it's adequate. And they said, oh crap, Tango was we wasted all that time. So they made AR Core, which is basically an Android version of AR kit. And I agree with you, Greg. I think what we're seeing, the AR we're seeing today is to headset-based real AR, HoloLens-like real AR, as today's artificial intelligence is to HAL 9000. I mean, I think real AR is a long way off, and that's acknowledgement from the companies, Apple and Google chiefly. They got nothing, so they're going to do this.
A lot of the times these Silicon Valley companies like to tie their shoelaces and then trip over themselves.
Yeah.
You know, their idea of being useful is to do something and then pretend it's awesome. And then when everybody ignores them, they go, well, you didn't like my baby, and have a good cry like Facebook does every other week. Yeah. I just feel like AR is something that's it's going to be useful, but nobody actually knows what it's useful for.
Well,
look at Google Glass, right? Google Glass is actually now continues on. It is a joke for any normal use case, but there are several industries that use Google Glass for mammoth tasks, medical in particular, where there's massive stuff actually happening. And in 10 or 20 years, maybe the Google Glass thing will turn around and come back into the consumer market, but I don't know if it'll be
that long, but it's at least 5 years off.
I mean, Vuzix has incredible industrial applications. You know, Boeing and airlines using it to rearrange the seats on an airliner.
This isn't even that new.
You can look down.
I went to the design labs at Ford 8 years ago. We did coverage, and they were using VR helmets to design to look at what it looks like to be inside a car they haven't built yet. This isn't new. This has been around forever and ever and ever, and it's nothing spectacular. There's a lot of issues that have to be solved. Battery issues, power issues, before you can have real augmented reality in a way.
And whether they can build these things so that they're non-obtrusive. I mean, whether they can be just essentially adjuncts to your glasses.
Yeah, because that's why Google Glass became a punchline, because you looked like a moron.
Right.
Well, people are wearing them more often. We do know that Apple's working on
AR glasses.
Yes, of course they are.
Yeah.
But Seth, what do you know? What is the time frame for that?
I don't know anything specific, but the fact that Apple's hiring people and that they're talking internally about it, I think it's a couple years away, two or 3 years.
Tim Cook's been saying AR for 2 years. You know, he's been really pushing it. Now, but so Apple's going to announce, you said this, Seth, I still don't get it. they're going to have tools that let two iPhones share augmented reality without storing it in the cloud. I can't wait to hear Larry Magid explain this to people on CBS News Radio. What? I don't even know what that means myself. What is that even? Who wants that? What does it mean? What does it look like?
I think it would be peer-to-peer kind of connection, like,
right? Well, no,
FaceTime with AR. I don't know.
you mean that thing where you could put little dog ears and a tongue on your face while you're talking to somebody? That
maybe you an emoji FaceTime. Animoji is quite popular with the kids today. Yeah.
Is it? Is it really?
I don't know.
Seth, do you know any kids?
I hope not.
I think they're reaching for a use case. So if you had your smartphone and, you're looking through here, and looking at a game on a desktop and you're playing it by yourself, that's kind of not very interesting. Why not just play a game on a screen? Why would you map out an AR and watch the orc go in and stamp the guy with a wand or whatever it is? But if you can get three or four people standing around a table holding their – but again, when you think about it, if you're holding your phone like this while you're doing a game, your arms get tired. That's why we have computers, so you sit down at a desk and play a game for hours.
And not to mention Pokemon Go, which, of course, came out with AR without having to get help from Apple and Android, two years ago?
That's not AR.
It's a tease of AR. I mean, they are superimposing computer graphics over the real world. So I don't know what you call that other than AR. It's a type of AR. It's primitive AR. But my
it's
point
putting
is
a picture. It's putting a picture over the top of your camera. There's a camera image coming on, and it just put the Pokemon graphic on top. It's not like it was, you know, dynamically generated.
Honestly,
it was a static image on top of the camera.
Honestly, most of the AR kit apps, that's exactly what they're doing.
What it is. Yeah, no, it's such a trivial use case that I just don't I think it's
you brought this up. What does phone-to-phone AR mean? I don't even know what that means.
So, like I said, I don't know what it means, but I imagine that the phone-to-phone thing is that so you're doing whatever you're doing and you're worried about the government looking at it and Apple says, hey, we don't have any knowledge of this because it's phone-to-phone, so don't ask us.
Yo, what are you
us.
Doing with that the government has no knowledge over? Why you should got, the government right. care?
You got ears and a tongue, and when you open your mouth, rainbows come out.
Oh, right. Bob Baller is really going to be interested in that one.
This sounds
Donald Trump
really
can talk
real
to his lawyer. And
yeah. What's funny is they're all just playing catch up to Snapchat, which has been doing this for the ages.
Yes,
right. They've got their own glasses now, right? They've got the second generation of their goggles or whatever.
I have still it. Have my Snapchat spectacles. Goggles. Yeah. I still have those.
Spectacles.
Waste this, of money.
This article that you refer to, Leo, sounds like it's just augmented reality shared between two iPhones is the logical progression of having it on one phone so that more than one person
it's
can play the game.
Twice as good.
So, but whoever's writing the articles run it through a privacy filter and gone, it's an anti-Facebook article banging on about privacy. Like, who gives a rat's?
No. What was the event? Was it the iPhone event where they showed off some augmented reality games? With a recent Apple event.
This was all at WWDC last
Was it
June.
That long ago?
Yeah.
God, so, I mean, there is obviously a gaming application that one could envision that would be a two iPhone.
It was such a toy. Every developer, because they as soon as they got ARKit, wrote their AR app. Their Twitter was filled with these ARKit-based apps. Oh, that's cool. And then that was that.
It's not.
Yeah.
That's how I got both of the standalone VR headsets that came out recently, the Oculus and the Lenovo, and I had 15 minutes of fun with each one of them, and they've all been on the shelf since.
15 minutes of fun.
That's about all I –
that's the story of the show.
Of exactly.
15 minutes of fun, baby. We're going to take a break and come back with another 15 minutes of fun. Greg Farrow is here.
It's the show title.
It's so great to have you, Greg, from Packet Pushers Network. Seth Weintraub, first time ever. Great to have you. I want to talk electric cars in a little bit and what's going on at Tesla. He's a publisher not only of electric.com, but 9to5, Mac, 9to5, Google, and his newest one, DroneDJ.com. Cool. And, of course, Larry Magid. The one and the only who's been on Twit more than probably anybody else in years.
Oh.
You've been with us since practically the beginning. CBS
practically.
News Radio, connectsafely.org. Larry and I have gotten gray together.
We have.
Yes. Our show today brought to you by the source of my favorite thing in the world, a good night's sleep. There's literally nothing better. Maybe it's just me at my age and my stress level, but if I've had a good night's sleep, I feel like this is as good as it gets. This is everything. Casper is there to bring you a lovely, exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. Casper is the first. They really created this, the online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost by eliminating the single biggest inefficiency in mattresses, the middleman. They cut the cost of dealing with resellers, of showrooms. They sell directly to you, and the savings go right in your pocket. And boy, are these great mattresses, obsessively engineered. I mean, the original Casper mattress has, this is actually the one I like, multiple supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that somehow magically gives you just the right sink, but also just the right bounce. It gives, but it's firm. It's like the perfect mattress. Its breathable design lets you sleep cool. That's important in these hot summer nights, and lets you regulate your temperature through the night. Long-lasting comfort and support. You buy it online, and because they know you didn't get to try before you buy, 100 nights, risk-free returns. No cost to you. If at any time in the first 100 days you decide you don't want it, they come, they get the mattress, they refund you every penny. That is the best guarantee in the business. Free delivery, painless returns, Shipping is free and returns are free in the U.S., in Canada, and the U.K. now, Greg Farrow. Casper mattresses uphold the highest environmental production standards. They come in a surprisingly compact box. You open it up, it springs to life. Get a Casper mattress today. You can save $50 on select mattresses if you go to Casper, CASPER.com/twit. Use the promo code TWIT at checkout to save $50 on select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. That's Casper.com/twit and use the promo code TWIT to save 50 schmackers.
Good news.
What's that? In the UK?
Good news. Yeah, because mattresses is one of those things that's really hard to get sorted out in a place where we don't have big roads and very few people have cars big enough to put mattresses in them. The home delivery thing is actually really quite useful.
I always laugh because I don't know why people don't know this, but I see this every once in a while driving down the highway. Somebody has strapped a mattress to their car roof.
Yeah.
And you just know, as soon as you hit 60 miles an hour, it's going to catch the wind and that's flying off. There's nothing that will hold that on there. Nothing.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's why you see mattresses in the road.
Mm.
Dopes.
Or they're tied on the roof and they're
dopes.
Bent back in half.
Yeah, the roof is open like a can opener. Dopes.
Yep.
Dope. All right. All right. No more Apple. I think we've got all the Apple stuff here that we need.
It's all going to be software and
content.
Everybody's going
to, you know, where Apple's really actually starting to make money is in services, and that really is content because it's the App Store, it's Apple Music, it's iCloud to some degree. They never break it down, so we don't know how much. But it was almost $10 billion last quarter. I'll give you an idea. The Apple services revenue was more than Mac and iPad combined. It's their number two revenue generator.
It is the number two revenue generator, but the thing that strikes me about the App Store generally is, A, how much money the games make. There were some numbers around games. It's just astonishing.
Amazing
how much money they're making out of those games. But also the fact that the ecosystem of the developers is collapsing. So the developers are saying, we can't survive as is. It originally came out as like this great big independent, indie developers. But Apple's got this platform squeezed so tight. That if you're trying to build a business on top of it, you're never going to win because Apple's got this paranoia that if anybody can make more money out of the platform than they can, then they lose control. Like, you remember, so Microsoft Office and Windows, the idea behind Windows was that we enable other people to make more money than we do. So the more people using Windows, the more money other people make, and we get dragged along behind them. So our platform follows those people. In Apple's case, they say, this is our platform, we own it, you can't have it. Right. And you have to live with the consequences of what you get. And it's up to you to decide, you know, whether you want to be on it. But we don't actually let you survive. So we don't actually care about you. It's all.
Yes. About. But there's so much money to be made. People put up with it. Look at this. This is from Statista. Apple doesn't break this down. But this is from Statista. The top grossing iPhone mobile app in the U.S. as of April 2018 is Fortnite. Now, you look at this number, $1.9 million, and you think, well, how – that's per day.
Wow.
That's almost $2 million.
That's like my kids and their classmates are doing that.
Day. I know. It's a great game. And you know what? It's a free game. It's free. And they're making $1.9 million a day. And you know what they're selling? Stupid digital goods, costumes.
Yeah. So not exactly an innovation.
One
not exactly
Candy Crush
changer.
Saga, $1.3 million a day. Pokemon Go, almost $1 million a day.
So and this Apple is why gets people 30% of that.
The way, that's where you get $10 billion in revenue because Apple gets a third of it. Yep.
And I think what that highlights is just how bad the competition is. Why is it that Google is so bad at Android that they haven't got an app store that could do better than this?
I don't know that they're not doing better than this. They probably aren't because Apple. Traditionally, Apple users are willing to spend more, but I think that the Google app Android store is not a complete laggard. Let me see if I can find numbers for that.
Sure.
Google's not broke.
Does Google take the same percentage from Android store sales?
No.
I believe so. 30%. I think they had some, like, they gave some other things a cut, like the carriers or something
else. Isn't there a difference in in-app purchases that Apple takes a cut and Google allows you to do your own in-app thing without going through them? I remember there was some issue with
it. It is a lot less. Same source, leading Android apps in the Google Play Store worldwide by revenue. Whoops. Candy Crush Saga number 145 million.
Oh, yeah. Pennies.
And so it's like a 20th, really.
Yeah.
Still. And Fortnite isn't even on Android yet.
Not yet. But still, honestly, $45 million a day, I'd take it. I mean, I'm not going to say no.
Yeah. I mean, it's good money in terms of because a handful of handful of kids sitting around computers whipping up some crazy graphics means it's an enormously profitable business.
It's Candy Crush Saga. So. It's actually grandma that's pumping money into that one.
Probably. But, I mean, the product that you're generating here is trivial. The thing that makes me sad is, first of all, it's absolutely trivial. None of these things are changing the world. Why is it not people doing business on this phone? Why are there no business apps here that actually make real money?
Well, it's always been that way. Come on. That's the way the world is.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm going to have a bit of a whine. I'm going to get up here on my hobby horse and ride it around and say, you know, like, this is not changing the world. This is a bunch of people playing stupid games. They're not improving their lives or brain training. At least, I mean, brain training was rubbish, but at least people were trying or pretending that they were improving the world or themselves. Right?
They've just given up. Now they're playing Clash of Clans.
They're just playing Fortnite, you know, or Clash of Clans or some other stupid thing. I mean, this isn't really like this is. We're having arguments about how rubbish Facebook is.
This reminds me of Newton, you know, in the vat when he called television the vast wasteland. Yeah. I mean, it's the same story, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's always been that way. Mass products, mass appeal products. They're not changing the world.
Yeah.
For crying out loud. I mean, cup of noodles? Come on.
Ramen.
Ramen? Come on. I mean, life has always been that way.
Because cooking food is hard. You know?
Yeah. Facebook is removing trending topics.
Yeah.
What? This was the intractable problem they couldn't solve, which was... Basically, the fake news problem, right? The trending topics, it couldn't be done with humans.
News, the fake accusations from conservatives that there is bias and the fact that nobody looks at them to begin with. I had to go out of my way to remember where they were on my
screen. Oh, really? You didn't know.
Whoever looks at those damn things. Apparently, 1.5% of publisher clicks come from trending news. So it's essentially a non-product to begin with that's caused them nothing but anguish thanks to all the controversy. So why not get rid of it?
Yeah, actually, if we hadn't told people it was going away, they may have never ever noticed. Let me just see what's trending today.
Right, it's on the right, by the way, if you haven't looked. Yeah.
The page is still building, and now it's pushed down here. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School honoring its shooting victims. Dallas woman says she killed her husband for beating their pet cat. And a suspect is arrested after shooting in San Diego. Oh, and look, a big announcement from Facebook. We're removing trending news soon to make way for future news. After we're actually destroying your house to make way for an interspace bypass or whatever it was, right?
Yeah. I think
nobody's sitting in front of this bulldozer, I can tell you right now.
I think this is related to the article we've got further down here from Chartbeat. And Chartbeat is a company that puts analytics inside of web pages. And what they're now saying is that news sites are now getting more traffic direct on mobile phones than they are via Facebook. So over the last 5 years, we've seen news sites say that they want Facebook to send them traffic. And what they've realized is they actually just start telling people to come directly to their sites, people will.
Yeah.
And so now that the split has happened where the majority of people used Facebook to get the news, now they're going directly to people's the brand's websites, and they're all getting
Google
very
news.
Excited about it.
I'm still a heavy Google News user, especially on my mobile.
I like the new Google. Be honest with you, the new Google News beats Apple News. It's actually, if I show you my phone, it's on the front page of my phone. It's I really like it,
and their algorithms are good.
Yeah, and they do something I think is admirable, and they trumpeted this, if you'll forgive the inadvertent pun, they trumpeted this at Google I.O. They said, there's going to be Leo's briefing, you know, there's the top five stories for Leo, But then everything else, the headlines, everybody who reads it will get the same headlines.
Which I think is absolutely essential.
We're not going to do the algorithm on news. Right. And I think that's actually really admirable.
I agree.
That's probably the real story here is the failure of algorithms.
Yeah. I said AI from now on, it stands for algorithmic idiocy.
The fact is that the idea of tailoring news around your biases, basically.
Yeah.
To me,
what could go wrong?
It's a challenge to democracy, right? You're a conservative, you get conservative news. You're a liberal, you get liberal news. How does that help us resolve any of our problems?
Seth, you probably know better than anybody. What are important traffic drivers for your publications?
So in this space, Apple News is clearly a big one. Flipboard, strangely or not strangely.
Well, Flipboard's huge on iOS, right? I mean, it's on Android, right. But I think it's huge on iOS, yeah.
Right. And then, you know, obviously Google News and then, you know, all the search, different search, basically the different ways Google sends traffic. Facebook is and Twitter are both kind of middle ground. We never invested in any kind of Facebook anything because I kind of felt like Facebook wasn't really our buddy. They didn't really seem like.
You were very right, weren't you? You turned out to be right when everybody else chased Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, Facebook was also handing out a lot of cash to some publishers to work with them. So, you know, it wasn't dumb. I probably, if somebody gave me, $500,000, I would have probably done some Facebook videos, but, you know, we still push out to Facebook. We didn't, you know, delete Facebook or anything, but, and we do have an audience there. I think we have like 300,000 people on 9to5 Mac and, you know, a few less on the other sites. So, we use Facebook like everybody else, but we don't really promote it. We don't say, hey, you know, go to our Facebook page or anything like that.
Yeah, we did Twit did the same thing on a much smaller scale than you guys, but Twit did the same thing with both YouTube and Facebook. I never really trusted either of those platforms to look out for my own best interests. Just as you said, Greg, they're not.
Yeah, they're not.
They're not.
I never understood why people push their Facebook pages over their own websites. I mean, you know, you control twit.com. I mean, that you own that.
Right.
And
actually, I don't, but I control twit.tv.
TV,
I don't know who has twit.com.
sorry about that. But you know what I'm saying. Why?
I think a lot of them got onto Facebook because they got analytics that worked. And it was all because, you know, a bunch of smart developers at Facebook put some analytics. So when people went to the page, you could see people coming from the page and then coming to your website. And that made you feel like you're in control. It was a false dawn, of course, because nowadays these publishers are realizing they have to build their own technology and they're hiring the same developers. They're building their own code. They're building out their – ditching their old 40-year-old content management systems and growing up and getting something a bit modern. And now the analytics engines that they have are of a quality that – well, they should have had 10 years ago. They have to be technology companies. And they've kind of been through this, you know, oh, we'll get Facebook to do it for us. We'll get Facebook to do our ads. We'll get Google to do our ads. And then realizing that was the dumbest thing we ever did. We've got to take it all in-house.
I'm going to be apostate here and say I'm not convinced that analytics are all that useful either. I think that that's become, in a similar way, that's become a kind of a religious – you know,
illusion of control.
Believe,
you
yes,
think you're
it's
in
an
control,
illusion.
But you're not.
It's an illusion. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we look at analytics, but I think from a point of view of advertisers, I understand. You know, advertisers know that at least half of their money is wasted.
They just don't know which half.
They just don't know which half. Right. In the old saying.
But that's the same.
And they're trying to figure it out. I don't blame them. They want their ads to be more efficient, but. Ultimately, I don't know if analytics are the holy grail either.
It's an illusion of control. They sold the vision of I can track every click, I can track every impression, and that's going to be better than what you're doing now. And, of course, what we're seeing, of course, is big consumer brands pull out and go back to television and radio. They're pulling out of YouTube.
Isn't that interesting?
Because they're not getting the traction that they want. Yes, they could. The only time that targeted advertising works is when you're really trying to reach a really specific audience like the political one. So if you're trying to get somebody who lives in a suburb of, you know, like if you're trying to target people who live in Cheltenham in the UK where I live, and you just want people who are in the upper echelon and you want to target them with your high-end clothing brand, well, you know, these types of analytics-driven systems are perfect. But if you're Procter & Gamble and you're trying to promote, you know, washing liquid or something like that, why are you on Facebook? I don't think that's actually useful overall.
Well, I think that's an example of the analytics persuaded them. But I think the analytics is a shibboleth. People treat it as if it's, you know, the holy grail for advertising. It's turning out not to be, I don't think, all that useful.
I guess if you're a salary
interesting. I had not heard this. Big brands are going back to their brand advertising on mainstream.
Yeah, they're definitely
media.
Pulling out of, they're winding back presence. Like Cisco, for example, has backed off YouTube completely. Now they're no longer doing any ads on YouTube.
Well, that I understand. I mean, YouTube is the biggest a scam in history.
If I have to watch another Wix ad, I swear I'm going to put something through my screen. I mean, but the challenge, I think, with is the illusion of control. And remember, a lot of the times that they put these ads on these platforms, and there's some salary slave there with a high school education who's looking at an analytics platform trying to justify their reason for earning minimum wage in an office job that's pretty cool. You know, it's a good job. They don't have to do a whole lot of work. They just have to put some ads on a platform and pretend. And if you can click a button and show that you did 10% better than you did last month, well, hello, you know, job done. I'm a legend. Give me a pay rise.
But it's interesting because, I mean, in a way, the reason we have GDPR is because of, you know, the European privacy regulations is because of ad tech and the concern of consumers that they're being tracked and surveilled by companies. And really the reason companies track and surveil them is for targeted advertising. And wouldn't it be ironic if advertising targeting didn't work? And so the whole thing brought the house down for no good reason that, you know, I don't know. Seth, you must have an opinion on this. God, you've been doing this for ages.
I do. Yeah. So I think there is some value to targeted advertising, specifically as you kind of pare down. You're right. The Procter & Gamble stuff that everybody needs maybe doesn't make sense for. But for instance, iPhone cases, like what's a good place to advertise iPhone cases? Probably 9to5Mac, you know, or you know, Apple sites.
But you could do that without. But you could do that without targeted advertising because Mac users are going to go 9to5 ads.
That's what we don't do any analytics on our audience. We don't have to. We just say you want to reach tech enthusiasts. 9to5Mac. You want to reach Mac users. Where else are you going to go? I mean, that's perfect. So
you want to reach old people, evening news.
But I bet you, Seth, your advertisers still come to you and say, "Well, I want to see some analytics."
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that. It's crazy because they have these ROI budgets that they can't like escape out of their brains.
Right.
So they come in and they say, well, you know, we need to make, you know, and they track the people from like our site to their site to the cash register and do they make a purchase?
Right.
And then they come back and they're like, well, we didn't really make, you know, exactly what we paid you or we you know, whatever. And I'm just kind of like, well, you know, like, oh, you got a lot of eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any.
Did you sell some cases? Just tell me. Did you sell, you know, all of our ads are direct response ads, which is why you hear in an ad, you'll have a custom URL or a promo code and all of that. And I shouldn't say this out loud, but so advertisers, sometimes we'll get advertisers say, well, this show doesn't work. And we say, well, all the promo codes I'm getting are TWIT. Yeah, but you didn't even buy ads on TWIT. You bought ads on that other show. So honestly, if you're getting ads, promo codes from TWIT, that's us. That's that show. And they don't know, but it doesn't match. It's there's a lot of that. There's way more of that than I'd like to acknowledge or admit.
That's hard.
Ultimately, for an advertiser, it's of course. I'm a business person. You're going to spend money on advertising. You have to do that. You hope that will make you more money than you spent. That's the real ROI. And if you sold more iPhone cases than it cost you to buy the ads on 9to5Mac, I think that's a success, regardless of what the analytics tell you. But they want more than that, I guess, right?
Well, they just want, like, they want their computer spreadsheet to, like, look, you know, and, you know, like, you know, we did an ad or something, and maybe some people didn't enter the promo code, or some people, like, came back a day later or a week later and made a purchase or left it in their cart or a million other different scenarios.
Right.
And if it doesn't match 100%, then they're like, well, I don't know if we can do this again or something. And I'm always like, it's not just this tracking stuff. There's like more to it. Like it's about the brand. It's about the awareness.
Cook six months until they buy something. You know,
yeah, exactly.
We've had that problem where 2 years later, after a podcast went through, customer rocks up in front of a – now, we work in enterprise IT at Packet Pushers, so we're a bit different game. But we've had people turn up to the vendor 2 years later and say, I heard your show 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I've been putting a project together. Yep. Now we're ready to go.
Yeah.
Right?
You don't get any credit for that.
Yeah. Yep. My favorite one, Seth, and you'll have done this, is next time somebody says to you, I didn't get any ROI, my favorite one is to say, well, maybe your product's junk.
Yes.
Nobody wants
it. Can't help you there.
Like, I can't help you if your product's not worth buying.
I can't help you. All we can do, we can lead a horse to water. We can't make them buy those Instagram shorts that I bought last night.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe don't say that out loud, but you can think it in your inside voice or something.
No, all of our products that we sell are perfect.
Yes. Actually, we turn down products that I don't support. So that is one thing.
Yeah, but I'm in the same boat.
We don't have a lot of ads, so it's an easy thing to do. Yeah, I don't want to do ads for stuff for belly fat on 9 to 5 Mac.
Yeah, or even
I have no idea like what ads are going to wrap around my stuff.
Always makes sense.
Right,
for us.
Right. No, I think that's... it's unfortunate because what's happened really is that because of the fetishization of numbers, that really most digital advertising now goes through Google and Facebook. I mean, they have something like 80% of the market because they can produce that kind of, you know, you can really fill your spreadsheet with stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Doesn't mean they're better. But just they can fill your spreadsheet with stuff.
We have customers coming in working with Packet Pushers Network, and the reason that they deal with us is because we don't do analytics-driven marketing.
Good for you.
So we won't target. We don't.
But we can do that too. You and I can do that because we're small. Yep. We're niches. We are a very specific niche.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, teens, according to TechCrunch, are dumping Facebook for YouTube, Instagram, and Snapchat. Actually, it's according to Pew. Pew does these great surveys, the Pew, American Life?
Pew Internet Research.
Yeah,
Pew Research Center.
Good, they do great stuff.
Yeah, so that's also the lead story on Larry'sWorld.com, which is Facebook slips, Snapchat grows among teens. But the real big issue on that story, the real shocker in some ways, is that 45% of the kids are online almost constantly when you ask them how long they're online, which is...
What?
Then if you add... You add the ones that are online several times a day, I think it comes to 89% of teens are online either constantly or several times a day. So that's a huge amount.
And also in the environment where they have mixed feelings about how, you know, they feel about social media. 24% say it's mostly negative. Only 31% say it's mostly positive. But nevertheless, 45% of teens spend I don't know what almost constantly or virtually constantly.
I have a podcast with the author of that, which again you'll find on Larry's World, and I couldn't get her to actually define what almost constantly means other than they keep looking at their phone. Yeah, there's the podcast right on top.
Yeah, but who's not almost constantly on their phone?
Well, you're always
constantly online. Your phone's always online, and it's always in your pocket.
It's freakingly addictive. And if I'm not on a computer, I'm on my phone. Even if I have 3 seconds of dead time waiting in the grocery line at the store, my phone, it's out.
Yep.
It's depressing.
Ever try to ask directions on the street, you know, when you want directions?
Why would you ask directions? You've got a smartphone.
But Google Maps is great when you're driving and not so great when you're walking. Because you're not walking fast enough for it to update in real time.
That's why this new augmented reality in Google Maps is
so great. They're doing that. That's actually one of the things they want to do.
That's why they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the meantime, I occasionally want to ask directions, but everybody's on their phone, and they're inaccessible.
Hey,
they're in their own little world.
Buddy.
Exactly.
Wow. What a world we live in. What can you say? But I mean, how many times you go to a restaurant and see a family sitting at a table and none of them are looking or talking to each other? They're all, even mom and dad, on their phone.
Yeah, it's really depressing when that's our family.
Yeah. But I have to tell you, I'm the canary in the coal mine. I'm an early adopter because I remember my kids berating me because I wouldn't put my BlackBerry down.
Mm-hmm. When my son was in college, he made us go on vacation to a, quote, resort in Mexico. It had no cell phone service. He actually researched it and found one that was in a dead zone and that didn't have an internet cafe.
See, I think that's the thing. I think kids understand how deleterious this is.
Exactly. He made me go through a week of detoxification.
I wouldn't accept that. No, nope. Well, you know, can't do it.
I love my phone, but I love my kids even more.
Oh, you must.
Yeah.
And they love YouTube even more. YouTube, Instagram, and Snapchat, number one. YouTube, 85% of teens say they use YouTube. Mm-hmm. 72% use Instagram. That's a big jump, isn't it? Because Snapchat used to be dominant. Instagram is just edging Snapchat.
Look at the right column, the one that they use the most, and that's where Snapchat is still dominant.
Still,
35%.
Yeah, a lot of time spent on
Snapchat.
Look
how low Instagram is on that one. It's only 15%, which is very interesting.
Well, I think Instagram lends itself to posting and moving on. Snapchat is an interaction that you continue. Mm-hmm. But only 10% use Facebook most often, and it's and it's only about half of the total usage.
Instagram's more like a blog for teenagers. For my daughters, Instagram's like a blog. So. Yep. I was here, I did this, I posed a picture
Snapchat
of me.
Snapchat is an interactive thing. I mean, they're always...
Snapchat is your messaging platform for you and your friends. Facebook is what you use to communicate with your grandparents. And that's why...
It used
and
to be your parents, now it's your grandparents, right?
I haven't met anybody in my daughter's... I've got two daughters at 20 and 17, and none of them in that group use Facebook for anything other than a sort of a public face. They use it occasionally.
I have a theory. You tell me, though. That's because they haven't yet faced the problem that the rest of us face, which is they've moved on. Their friends are right there. They're too young to have friend groups in multiple places. But as they get older... And they have friends who were in high school, friends who were in college, friends who are at that job, but they no longer work with. That's when Facebook will become valuable to them. And I if I were Facebook, I wouldn't necessarily be worried about this. For instance, my 26-year-old, who's been to two colleges, has lived in many countries, she does use Facebook. It's the only way she can keep track of a big...
She couldn't do that on Instagram or on Snapchat?
She uses Instagram, too, but the way you stay in touch and keep up on all this stuff. I left Facebook, and you know why I ended up going back? Because they had a Tech TV reunion I didn't know about, because the only way you could know about it was on Facebook. It's for diaspora communities. And I think that's why kids don't need it yet. But that doesn't mean they're not going to turn to it
No, I'll challenge you there. My teenagers are getting really good at burning relationships. So burning bridges, as you guys said.
That's why I don't need Facebook. I don't want to keep track of people.
Exactly. So my Facebook is deleted. I think it's about 10 days away from deactivation, and good bloody riddance to it as well. And
I did not miss it when I was gone, and I don't use it hardly anyway now, but it was the only way I could keep up with
Facebook
this group.
Because every now and then I need a login for something, and the only way I can do it is Facebook. But all I'll ever do is probably register and then delete it again. My daughter's do use tools to stay in contact with people, but because they're always on, they're always constantly talking, you can't carry all of those people along behind you. They just become a dead weight on you emotionally.
I agree.
I know nobody from my school, and I don't want to have anything to do with those morons, you know?
But there are people who like other people. You hate people. You're a misanthropist. Okay, I got it.
But I mean, move on. Like, doesn't life just keep moving on, and you make new friends and you go through a new phase? Why are you dragging your high school along behind you like some ball and chain?
Larry, you're an old guy. Yeah. Don't you cherish those relationships you've had over these golden years?
Well, the funny thing, they're the only friends I have are old friends. Nobody likes me anymore. But the old people still hug. But you know, my kids are in their 30s and they are still in touch with their high school friends. And I don't mean just like I am, like
that's Facebook.
Every 5 years. They know exactly. They go to parties when they travel. They visit them.
I think it's creepy, but
I don't think it's creepy. I think it's great. You know, if they like their friends.
There are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who like people and people who don't like people. There are people who like really cultivate and keep friendships, and they make a point of staying in touch and stuff. And I'm more like Greg. I don't want to.
I actually am still friends with people I knew in college in my first couple of jobs, but I don't talk to them.
Okay,
very often.
Seth, where do you come on this scale?
Okay, so there's two things I use Facebook for. One is my mom thinks Facebook is the internet. She's like in one of those countries Facebook is the internet.
Yes.
So if she wants to see pictures of our
kids.
Is that
Indiana? What country? Whatever. What country is that?
Yeah, Northeast Ohio. But yeah, okay. So
same thing.
That's a country.
It's just over the border. Actually, I was pretty close.
Yeah, actually, impressive. So we put pictures on there for them that we absolutely, and you know, sometimes it's through Instagram or whatever. And then the other thing is, like, I do look at stats, like, you know, whatever. But I look at stats on Facebook through 9to5Mac and all the other stuff. So, you know, as a publisher, I need to look at that stuff, at least know what's going on.
Oh, yeah,
so
I use Facebook. Yes. There are some people, and I'm one of them, that we there's a professional reason we have to keep up with Facebook. I have to know what Facebook going on Facebook so I can.
Right.
I just show Facebook, right?
Yeah. I mean, deleting Facebook for me isn't, sadly, even an option. Like, I wouldn't even consider it because of the business and my mom.
Aw, you're a good son, Seth. You're a good son. Our show today,
boy chick.
You're a boy chick. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. Talk about the old days. Remember, like, well, I remember when we bought our house 4 years ago, back in the 2014s, 13s. If you wanted a home loan, you went to a bank because that's where the money is, right? And the banker would have a sheaf of paper with all the rates on it. Our banker had a fancy mortgage amortization calculator. He was so proud of that. He'd put in numbers. He'd go, well, that's your payment right there. He'd do it again. He was so proud of that. And then, you know, you go through that indignity. Then he gives you an application, you know, 20 page. You got to take that home. You got to go to the attic and find your pay stubs from 3 years ago, bank statements from last century, and get all that together. And then send that packet in. And the irony of it was, and we went to the big bank, the bank everybody knows with this witch whips and the stagecoach and all that. And they came back again and said, well, we need go back to the attic. We need this and this and this. And it took 2 months. 2 months they were asking us to fax stuff to them from our vacation. Finally got the loan, but man, we almost lost the house. That is the way it used to be. Fast forward to 2018, baby, the modern times. Quicken Loans, the number one lender in the country, said this will not stand. We are going to make a way. You can get a loan entirely online. You can do it in a matter of minutes. You can do it from your phone. You could do it at an open house. It's called Rocket Mortgage. It's aptly named because it is fast. Rocket Mortgage is simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details, everything that's going on. They tell you, you can be confident you're getting that right loan. It's very easy. You don't have to go to the attic to get paperwork. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information at the touch of a button. It's very powerful. Rocket Mortgage can perform, get this, thousands of calculations in seconds. At best, that guy at the bank, he could do one amortization in about 45 seconds at best. Based on income, assets, credit, Rocket Mortgage calculates the numbers. This is usually less than 10 minutes. They can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify, find the one that's right for you. You specify the term, the down payment, the rate. They say you're approved. You show it to the realtor. You make an offer. It's that fast. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Really, this is the modern way to apply, or by the way, refi. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number 2. Get that right. They are paying attention. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. It would help us if you would do that. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for making This Week in Tech possible. We had a very good week this week. And in fact, it was such a good week, we prepared a short informative documentary for you to watch. Enjoy.
Previously on Twit.
After going to Japan, this is another thing I'm just going to strongly suggest. Mm-hmm. On the handkerchief.
iOS today.
One is for crying ladies.
Okay. We might need that.
Then you keep the other one in your pocket.
But that one, they came from the same pocket.
Okay, you see? Well, you don't want it. With crying ladies, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
So,
especially if you're the one that made them cry.
Well, that's, I guess, maybe why I know a lot about crying ladies.
This Week in Computer Hardware.
Did you see the Atari VCS?
I did.
That went
I
up
did.
On Indiegogo yesterday?
I am ashamed to say that I actually really want one of these.
Wow. Why are you ashamed outside of the fact that it's an Atari?
It's an Atari. I mean, it's absolutely a nostalgia play.
Tech News Weekly.
I thought we'd end the show by taking a look at what I got from Amazon. For the audio listeners, I will just say this is a pretty large box, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There. And at the bottom of the box, it's a package of Oreo cookies.
That is really the worst thing to happen to anyone.
Twit. Hashtag Pat's Check.
No, I think maybe this flavor might be the worst thing to happen to anyone.
I'm going to try it. Obviously, we have to wait until Tuesday. Yes. Unless Burke has his hand that he, his mechanical hand that steals all the Oreos. You want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroon.
I'm at Jason Howell. I'm not doing that. Megan's doing that to
I've
herself.
I've never seen that hand.
Jason, stop.
I want one of them.
That is awesome. I didn't know... We even had those. Also, that Atari VCS is weird. Who would pay $300 to play video games like we played in 1978?
Yeah, I got the original 2600 recently.
You have one?
$30. Well, it's just like the $30.
Oh, the $30 one. It's got all the games in it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I played Combat, and I remember playing Combat and having a good time and spending days playing it, and I couldn't play it for 10 seconds.
It's terrible.
It was the slowest, worst thing ever.
It's so terrible. But I have to say, I got that for our 15-year-old for Christmas. It was the number one Christmas gift. I notice he doesn't play it anymore, but at the time, he was very, very excited about it. So apparently,
that would be cool for me getting a black and white TV with rabbit ears as a way of
going
back to my childhood.
So people are paying, get. The hand is really creepy.
That is weird.
I just want to say that is really a creepy hand because it's very, it's like a little baby hand. It's, I don't know, for people listening at home, you're really missing nothing. It's just a creepy little baby hand on a stick. So, yeah, stop it. $299. For this collector's edition. And if you want the joystick, $29. That's crazy.
Yeah, but, you know, if you live in San Francisco, you probably spend that on a good night out on the booze.
Easily. Yeah, $200 doesn't get what it used to, did it? Does it?
Yeah, if you're a Silicon Valley type person and you're taking down $250,000 a year for a scut work day job like you get in Silicon Valley, then, you know, $300 is a sanity check.
Nothing.
No big deal.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Chicken feed. Did you see the protesters in San Francisco? So there's several things to protest these days in San Francisco. One, of course, is the fact that housing prices are through the roof. Nobody can afford to live there anymore because they say because of the tech bros and all the companies and the housing crisis. And so there's people upset about that. And then there's these scooters.
Oh, God.
Bird.
Death traps. Everywhere.
So they're everywhere. I first saw them in Santa Monica, and it is bad because people ride the scooter. It's $3 to ride it. You use your phone to activate it. You go, zzz, you get to where you're going, and then you just hop off, and then you leave the scooter, and there's scooters everywhere. So in San Francisco, protesters decided to combine the two. And they piled a bunch of scooters up in front of the Google bus or one of the buses.
Did you know that there are over 50?
Set them on fire.
Oh no!
And no, actually, that's a fake fire. They didn't actually destroy anything. But that's very San Francisco.
It just flares.
It just flares. But it's very San Francisco.
Have you ever ridden one of those scooters? They look deadly.
I actually own a couple of them.
Yeah.
Okay. They are deadly. For people our age, bad idea. But if you're a kid, you're used to it. The problem is they have these electric motors that are super high torque.
Right. They're fast, yeah.
Yeah, they're not just fast. You press the button, they go, whoa!
Right.
It's like a bucking Bronco. So you really have to learn that you get the scooter going with your foot, like a real scooter, and then you very carefully, gently depress the trigger. Otherwise,
but it's a rental. Who knows? How do you know that when you put your $3 down?
Well, that's right.
You've been on one before,
you won't. The learning curve is steep.
You learn
quickly. There's also, as long as we're talking scooters, a whole new business.
Turns out these scooter companies will pay people $15 to charge the scooter. That's a problem they have, right? Nobody's they're just riding them. Nobody's charging them. So high school kids have gone around gathering scooters and bringing them to somewhere they can plug them in for pocket money. Actually, pretty good money. You could buy one of those Atari VCSs for that.
A good day's work will get you an Atari. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
it's a weird model, like, for sure. Like, it's crazy, but like the idea that, you know, you could just pick up a scooter outside of whatever building you're at.
It's awesome.
And go to another building. There is some.
Oh, it's like, it's awesome.
I don't know. I have a feeling there's going to be a problem. So I was in Seattle recently and they've got these bikes or similar thing with bikes. I found bikes everywhere. I mean, in residential neighborhoods.
Oh, you can't. It's not like the city bikes where you have to dock it in the bike.
No, they're dockless bikes. And the problem is people leave them. They take them home to the suburbs where they live where nobody is going to want to rent it. And so they're just sitting around in these odd, random places. And I saw one near my hotel, and it was there for the whole time I was in Seattle, 3 days. That bike was still in the same exact spot because where I was staying, I guess nobody wanted to rent a bike. So
I think this probably started with Google, right? Because Google has bikes in front of every building.
They're for employees, yeah.
They lose, according to Bicycling Magazine, more than a hundred bikes every week disappear.
Wow. Yeah. Permanently. People just throw them in rivers. The challenge has been that they throw them in the river.
And that's the other problem. Dumpsters and stuff. Yeah, you see them all over the place.
We don't have rivers in Silicon Valley.
There's a creek full of Google bikes. I have a picture. Creek, yeah.
And if you have an event like a concert or something, people just ride up on it and then just start throwing them on top of the other bikes. And then you actually find emergency exits all blocked up with bikes piled up. And what do you do when you've got 5,000 bikes piled up outside of a concert hall?
In the 60s, there was a group called the Provos in Amsterdam. I think it was an anarchist collective. And they actually bought these bikes and put them all over Amsterdam with this great sort of socialist.
Amsterdam is very bike-friendly.
It didn't last because these bikes basically were stolen. But it was a great idealistic concept for a while.
Yeah.
The remedy to this is that you build infrastructure and you put, bike parking lots outside of every building.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Like, frankly, it's not such a crazy idea. I very much enjoy getting around cities on bikes.
Or electric scooters. I mean, it really, it beats the traffic. The problem is people ride them on the sidewalk. They ride them irresponsibly. And then, the scooter companies say, it's not our fault. People are not obeying the law. They're not wearing their helmets or they're not. But
yeah,
there is some responsibility that goes.
Well, the problem is that when you rent a bike, it's hard to have. They don't rent. They don't include helmets with the bike. So that's a tough one. In fact, New York City had a law that you had to rent a helmet. But New York was actually sanctioning bikes. One of these bike things in New York where you can't get a helmet. So they had to modify the law, as I understand it. So people who rented the bikes could legally ride them without helmets.
That's one way to solve it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have
they
a fold-up
bike. They end up just becoming litter,
travel with.
Well, that's what these Bird scooters in Santa Monica, they just were strewn everywhere. And San Francisco might even be worse because there's several, Bird will be there, but other companies, and Lyft has just gotten approval to do bikes.
San Francisco government of San Francisco, I don't know what it's called, a council, city council?
Supervisors, the board of supervisors.
They've just announced that they're only going to license 4 scooter companies and they're going to put a whole bunch of conditions on them. So a couple of scooter companies have just gone out of business because they didn't make the cut.
Oh, that's too
bad.
On the other hand, I have to say, driving in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, is a nightmare. The city is not friendly to cars. They'll tow you. The tickets are huge. There's very little parking. It's not designed to be friendly for cars. And I think really this is a first step maybe towards making urban areas a car-free zone, which I don't think would be a bad thing at all.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of there's an email that I get every week. It's a French analyst, and he's predicting that this idea of micro-mobility is going to be the next biggest wave. And what he's trying to point out is that 80% of all journeys are like 1 to 5 kilometers long.
Right.
So
right.
Why are you owning a car? You don't really want a self-driving car. You just want something that's better than walking or whatever. So this idea of hiring a scooter or a bicycle does matter, especially in Europe, where a lot of the streets are, driving a car is pointless most of the time. Like London, for example, you spend more time getting down to the tube than you spend on the tube.
Yeah.
you know, be a lot easier on a good day to just ride an electric scooter from point to point.
You need to be pretty careful about making sure cyclists stay off the sidewalk. In Japan, I was in Japan a couple of weeks ago, and people ride bikes on the sidewalk everywhere, and they ride it at full speed. It's kind of terrifying. Nobody seems to get hit. Everybody seems to coexist, but it's kind of scary.
You know, the irony is that the biggest sponsor of the bikes in San Francisco is Ford, which is calling itself a mobility company. And they actually see this as part of their strategy on how they're going to survive with the current, you know, young generations of people who are not buying two cars per family like my generation did. So bikes are sort of the last mile in Ford's strategy, I think.
I'm only a couple of miles from work, and I would segue or bicycle or scooter to work, except that there's no good way to go.
Did you say segue?
We happen to own a segue or two, yeah.
Oh, okay.
that's where they went.
Why? I love my segues. Okay, I admit I look like an idiot on it, especially with my pink shorts, but as you can see, I have no pride. I know. What was I saying? Oh, but the infrastructure doesn't support it. It's the only ways to go is through heavily trafficked corridors that I just don't feel safe riding.
Right.
So that's part of it. I think you're right, Seth. I think if cities want to make it welcoming to these things, that would be on balance a good thing, I think. But they have to do that instead of just saying, you can't, you know, you kids, get off of my lawn with your scooters.
The other thing is they can make scooters a lot lighter. If they can make them a little bit lighter, I guess, then they can become personal and you can, you know, carry your, you know, your backpack around with it.
Our son, I'm so proud of him. He goes to school pretty far away, like 20 miles away, his high school. He takes the smart train. There's a light rail from Petaluma to San Rafael. He carries a folded up electric scooter with him.
Great.
He gets off the smart train and scooters to school, a mile and a half to school, scooters back to the train, rides the train home.
That's great.
Isn't that awesome? That's, and that's not even an urban area. We're in rural Northern California.
Yeah. That's the future.
I love it.
Yeah. I have a fold-up bike, which it's not quite small enough to take on an airplane, but I can keep it in the back of my car. And when I go into San Francisco, I often just park anywhere. And
that's
just
a great idea.
Take the bike out of the back of the car.
Yeah. There was a service in San Francisco. I bet they're out of business right now. You'd press a button. It was a valet car service. You'd just say where you wanted to be. The guy would ride a scooter up to you.
Oh, right.
Get in the car, park it, and then he'd bring it to you when you were done. So you didn't have to worry.
Makes beautiful sense.
Isn't that a great idea?
In a sense, that's what driverless cars are all about, right? The idea of the autonomous vehicle is going to pick you up, drop you off, and go find a place to park if you own it, or it'll go take someone else for a ride if it's a fleet car.
That's a future I look forward to. I think that's
or maybe even if you do own it, maybe you could make some money, you know, even if you own the car, why can't you get paid to have it drive somebody else around while you're, you know, in your meeting or at work?
Let's take a little time out. We'll come back with more. We've got a great panel. Larry Maggott is here, CBS News Radio. Always a thrill. How's your back? Feeling all right?
It's all right. I love your breaks because they gave me a chance to stretch.
Take a walk. Take a hike.
You make money, I get my back relief.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's a win-win.
Seth Weintraub's here. He is, of course, the founder and publisher of 9 to 5 Mac, 9 to 5 Google, and electric.com. This is an electric car publication. I think your heart's in that one. For some reason, I feel like that, Seth.
It's the latest of my babies, so it's...
Yeah. And the new one... Which is DroneDJ.com.
Right.
It's not just DJIs, though. It's all drones.
It's all drones, but, you know, you kind of think about DJI because they're king. 80% of the market.
They're the king of the hill. Are they that big, that dominant? Wow.
Yeah, the consumer space.
I miss my Mavic Pro. I hope it's enjoying its retreat in the Caribbean.
Extended holiday.
Greg Farrow also here from the Packet Pushers Network. It's getting late, I know. So we're gonna hurry and get you home.
Oh, don't do that. We're having so much fun.
I want to tell you what I cooked for dinner the other night. We've been having so much fun. You know, we're big Blue Apron users. We usually do two or three Blue Apron menus a week. And, there's a barbecue wings recipe that is so, so good. It's just mouthwateringly good. And then what did I make the other day? It's just so much fun. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient recipe delivery service in the country. You don't have to worry about meal planning. You get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. You know, at the end of the day, you don't really want to plan, shop, and cook. But what if you went home and it's like you had a sous chef. All the ingredients you needed were there, beautiful too, just perfect, all ready to go. All you have to do is get out the pan and cook them. By the way, they're very sensitive about that. They very often reuse pans. What was it we cooked the other day that was so good, Lisa? Oh, the Kung Pao chicken was amazing. It even had a little Kung Pao pepper, the really hot Chinese peppers in there. Oh, it was so good. And so that's a perfect example. You know, if I bought a box of Chinese peppers, I would use it once and then I would have a box in my fridge for the rest of my life. But it comes with one. It's perfect. Just you need a little teaspoon of soy sauce. That's what you get. You get exactly the ingredients you need to make the recipe. And it's fun, too. I made that one with the ramen bowl. I made that. Michael liked that. He didn't eat the hard-boiled egg, but I did. I loved that. That was really good. Oh, no, he did eat the hard-boiled egg. Yeah. That was, it's awesome. It's great when you have kids. They learn to cook. They participate. They get excited about the food. It's a really great skill for them. It's great for me. I like to cook. But I often cook the same thing over and over because I can't think of something new. So Blue Apron gives me new horizons. We've been doing the Airbnb menu for a while. They were doing menus from Airbnbs all over the world. We did one from, I think the Kung Pao chicken was from Shanghai. It was really, really good. Mediterranean food like seared salmon and spicy orange salsa. Centered around fruits, veggies, lean meats, plenty of olive oil. You'll love the Mediterranean menu. They're nutritious but delicious. Chef-designed recipes. My mouth waters every time I do these ads. I go crazy. Blue Apron delivers fresh pre-proportioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to you. You choose what you want. They have 12 new recipes every week. You can choose 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits your schedule. If you're not going to be home, you can delay it. You don't have to get it every week. You can count on non-GMO ingredients, meat with no added hormones. The Blue Apron menu changes every week. They won't repeat more than once a year. Do you see the Chrissy Teigen stuff? Look at that. Chrissy Teigen's sweet and spicy chicken lettuce cups. Look at that. They've teamed up with Chrissy Teigen, best-selling cookbook author, to bring you some of her favorite recipes to make at home. Get ready for 6 weeks. I love it that Blue Apron does things like this. These events are so much fun. Of wildly fun, flavorful cooking, featuring recipes like garlic and soy-glazed shrimp with charred broccoli and hot greens pepper sauce. By the way, that's a new thing I've been doing. You do something like that. So we instead of steaming the broccoli, we put it in the toaster oven and charred it. It was so good. That's how we make broccoli now. We learned it from Blue Apron. Sesame chicken noodles with bok choy. Blue Apron, I love it. Check out this week's menu. Get your first 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/twit. That's pretty good. 3 meals free with free shipping. blueapron.com/twit. Blue Apron is a better way to cook, and I hope I didn't make you all hungry.
Starving.
Yeah, me too. New emojis are here. The new emojis are here. Are you ready? Are you excited? Here's from the emoji committee of, actually it's Jeremy who's on the emoji committee. He's at Emojipedia. The brand new emojis, pleading face, woozy face, smiling with three hearts, hot and cold face. Those are red-haired people. Apparently they haven't had those in the past. Curly-haired people, all the curly-haired people are happy. And finally, for people like me. White-haired people. Plus bald. Gotta have bald people. No hair at all. Super villain, male or female. Superhero, also male or female. Kind of strangely, weirdly disembodied body parts, like a leg and a foot. But if you think that's weird, there's also a tooth and a bone.
Ew.
Goggles and a lab coat if you're into science, like Ivanka Trump. Hiking boots, women's flat shoes. There's a microbe, mosquito, parrot, badger. That's not a skunk. That's a badger. Peacock, raccoon. Again, not a skunk. Swan, kangaroo, and lobster. The skunk lobster. Oh, I got to point out, though, we mentioned this when they first proposed it. That is not a uncooked lobster. Lobsters are not red. That is a cooked lobster.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's going to be controversial?
It has to be.
It has to be.
Everything's controversial.
A strangely prancing hippopotamus. Now, these are the proposed, these are kind of the, these are not necessarily what you'll get from Facebook or Google or Twitter or Apple. They do their own. They'll have a hippopotamus, but it won't necessarily be the prancing fancy pants hippopotamus that the folks at Unicode have proposed. There's a llama.
Climate change. They have their own emoji.
Who?
People who deny climate change. Do they get their own emoji?
Yeah. It's called Mooncake.
Mooncake.
Compass, luggage, bricks and skateboard. There's something for everybody. Flying disc, not a Frisbee note. That would be a trademark violation. A pawn, a softball, a jigsaw, toolbox magnet. It's really, yeah, you're bored. Aren't you?
Yeah.
You don't, that's because you're old. Young people, emojis are so very important to them.
That's how they communicate. Also, it's like hieroglyphics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Keep up the good work. Well, isn't the Chinese alphabet sort of just a whole series of emojis in a way?
I guess it is, isn't it?
You know? Yeah.
It's
so they got it right. Yeah. Works for them.
Pictograms, they call it.
Yeah.
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 I don't know about this picture that the AP has put out. I don't know who these people are. But the story is a hacker gets 5 years for Russian-linked Yahoo security breach. Karim Baratov was fined $250,000. I think that's the judge. I don't know. No, it says U.S. judge, and that's clearly not a U.S. judge. I don't. This picture doesn't seem to make any sense. No.
I couldn't make any sense of it either, for what it's worth.
Who are these people? Yeah. It's not Kareem. He's a young guy. He's 23. Yeah. I don't see him in the picture. Maybe he's the. Maybe
she looks.
Maybe he.
She looks
maybe
a little like Roseanne Barr, but I don't.
Yeah,
think
maybe that. I don't know what's going on in this picture.
unless but it's the person in the middle at the back.
It's. You think that this whole picture really that this guy is the perp. And the rest of it, they couldn't get a clear shot.
That's the parents and the lawyer.
Mom and dad and the barrister, because it was in Canada, right?
In which case, they didn't do a very good job with the iPhone of taking a photo.
I know. So Baratov worked with Russia. His name is Russian, but he's not. He's Canadian. He was born in Russia. But he was charged with using data passed to him by Russia's Federal Security Service to hack email accounts of journalists, business leaders, and others. It turns out Baratov was running a international hacker for hire business. Mm-hmm. He put out a shingle, well, a website in this case, in which a website named WebHacker, and he advertised in Russian and advertised for the hacking of email accounts without prepayment, which is, I think, good marketing. This is a file photo.
Company on the internet today,
and that's his parents. Yeah, okay, that's a file, and that's his lawyer. Okay, in Hamilton. Okay, there you go. That's from a year ago, though. So that's as close as they get. All right,
it's a good business, though. He collected $1.1 million in fees, which he used to buy a house and expensive.
He was driving fancy cars. He was driving a house.
Yep.
But the thing is, he was a dupe, basically, of the Russian security service.
He wasn't a dupe. He was getting paid. Well, he just wanted the cash.
Okay, dupe. Yeah. But he didn't know what he was doing.
Where can we find? We need a young Canadian to hack email addresses.
He's going to be like some Silicon Valley CEO, and he's going to go, like, you're giving me money because I am the smartest security hacker on the planet. That's why you're – obviously, I'm successful because I'm the best.
He was pretty good. So he orchestrated the one of the Yahoo breaches. I didn't realize there were multiple ones. The overall Yahoo loss was 3 billion accounts.
Right.
He's only responsible for the first half billion.
No.
In 2014, he was named in the indictment that charged two Russian spies with orchestrating the Yahoo breach. And apparently Baratov used that stolen data to hack then journalists, business leaders, and others. So Russian influence. So actually, I guess what that means is that Yahoo breach was all about the Russian security services getting the credentials for a few people that they wanted to target. And the rest of us, we were just collateral damage.
Yep. That sounds about right. Yeah. But he apologized and promised to be a better man and obey the law on his release.
In 5 years, he's going to Silicon Valley, baby. He's got a job waiting for him.
He's going to be and they're going to love him because he's been a been a successful CEO, but failed. Yep. Remember, failure is important.
Failure's
in Silicon
good.
Valley.
Nothing wrong with failure.
You can't have somebody in charge of a startup if you haven't failed at least twice.
Oh, good. And, I qualify. That may be the only qualification I have. But
pretty much my life story.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else? I don't know if this has any merit or value, but it's kind of an interesting factoid. Microsoft surpassed Alphabet's market cap this week. There is a race going on to become the first company to reach $1 trillion in market cap. Apple's pretty close. I think they're close to 900 million. Alphabet's in there, too. Google's in there.
Did they say where Microsoft is getting the bulk of that money? Because, I mean, it's different than it was back in the old days when it was all about packaged software.
Yeah.
You know, so much of that is cloud-based today. But I don't know if they broke it down.
I don't know.
It's future value. It's not past value. What the market is very pleased to see is the cloud business, the Azure business, is really accelerating away. Microsoft is now.
But if you're excited about Microsoft's cloud business, why would you value them higher than Alphabet?
Because it doesn't work Azure's that way. Because Microsoft's Azure business is going to be worth a lot more money. So Google's working in the consumer market, putting ads in front of eyeballs.
Right.
But that market has reached its maximum size. There's not more eyeballs to reach, whereas Microsoft through Azure, and like as we've seen with Amazon's AWS, they're just starting to open up the market in cloud computing. So the potential for future revenue growth and Microsoft's demonstrating the ability to transition people away from their legacy infrastructure and suck them into the Azure and trap them in the cloud so that all the future revenues get fairly firmly forwarded to Microsoft shareholders. And what we're seeing is that Microsoft's investments, so Microsoft's now outspending Google on R&D and CapEx in terms of building out its cloud because it's already got the revenue on the board.
What's interesting is that the prices were pretty much in sync going up through February of this year. And then Google, actually, let's make it late March. Google pretty much flattened out while Microsoft continued to go up. So I don't know what the news was at that point. But
I remember when they had their big developers conference just about a month or two ago, and the big news out of that was that Windows was hardly even on the agenda. I mean, it was
yeah, the market liked cloud. That.
The market liked it. And I was up there last week and met with people. And again, it's all cloud. I mean, it's Azure and other. And to the extent that they are a software company, it's software by subscription as opposed to actually purchasing your software. So, you know, like a lot of other people, I write my $100 a year check to Microsoft. It's kind of painless, but over the long run, that's going to add up to a lot of money with a lot of ease.
Tell me this, Larry. You don't actually write a check, I hope.
No, I don't write a check, but I do pay $100 a year. It comes out of a credit card.
I know. When did I last write a check? Is that funny? I mean, we used to write checks all the time, and nobody writes checks anymore.
My wife has a checkbook. I almost never use it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in a couple of generations, we'll still be saying writing checks. And the kids will go, what's a check?
Well, people talk about filming. You know, people say, oh, I filmed this movie.
When's the last time you dialed a phone?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I believe most of what it is that Microsoft is in their cloud. They're showing good growth. They're investing heavily. So they're spending 12% of their revenue as CapEx to grow it out. And they are very strong globally. So where AWS is particularly strong in the US.
It's a very US-centric business, isn't it? Yeah.
They're growing very fast. They're spending heavily. So, you know, I don't want to understate what they're doing. But Microsoft has very strong business in Asia and Africa and Europe. Yeah. They have more data centers up and running now. They're not as big as AWS. AWS has tended to build less numbers of data centers but make them phenomenally larger. And of course, they're running into power problems. So they're not able to get enough power to keep that model going. So Microsoft's decision to have smaller and more data centers is generally worked
out. Interesting.
Better, yeah.
That's a good insight.
They have, so everybody's struggling to get power, because when you want to get like, you know, 10 megawatts, 50 megawatts, 100 megawatts, and you want to put like 250,000 computers in four data halls, you know, you're trying to sign a 20-year agreement to get power. That's the whole output of a power station.
And or a Bitcoin miner.
Yeah, that's right. Wow. I think the Bitcoin mining thing is just one of those industries that's a flash in the pan until we see the next generation of ASICs. There'll be some re-spins. We'll see an FPGA or an ASIC or a dedicated. Today we're using general-purpose GPUs to do crypto mining. It would make more sense to have custom ASICs for those, and it'll be a few more years before they come around, and then we'll see the power curve drop right off.
Although apparently Bitcoin mining uses as much power now as Ireland.
Yeah. But I do feel that eventually there'll be the companies out there designing ASICs. Remember, Apple bought PA Semi to do the ARM chip and then to redesign it. It took 5 years for that to come along. Bitcoin's really...
You think there'll be custom ASICs just for Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, there's already a lot of crypto ASICs out there today.
Is there such a thing as a generic blockchain ASIC?
I think there will be, in the same way that we're seeing Google do Tensor Processing Unit for AI.
Are the computations involved in all cryptocurrency roughly the same? What is it, prime number factoring? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, it's all crypto. So there's plenty of crypto chips out there, but I'm not a blockchain expert. But it does make sense that when there's a market big enough and when it becomes static, like at the moment there's too much iteration around the crypto algorithms and the software, but at some point that market will reach a plateau, and that'll be the point when we see custom ASICs just for Bitcoin mining come out. I would imagine that there are companies out there designing them, you know, Cavium, Broadcom, the usual criminals.
I'm just looking if I can find a cryptocurrency ASIC. I mean, there are specific ASIC miners designed for cryptocurrency, but they're not probably tuned to blockchain particularly.
Well, the GPU does the functionality quite well. But, you know, Cavium, for example, has been producing a crypto chip that we've been using in network appliances for the last 15 years. And that has just been used for the TLS and the HTTPS and the IPsec. And that chip has been widely used. That must not be easily adapted for use in these, or maybe it's not fast enough. But they've been using GPUs. Now, GPU is a general-purpose graphics processor. It's like what Intel is on the x86. It's a general-purpose piece of silicon. But at some point, when the market gets big enough, it makes sense to make a custom ASIC that does just the things that you need.
That's actually, though, not necessarily – that may be not a benign influence on the problem of Bitcoin mining, because it just continues to concentrate the mining into a small group of people, right? Because these are very expensive – presumably going to be very expensive chips.
Well, you know, this is what I mean. The there has to be a plateau. There has to be enough demand. Right. There has to be enough people who want them, you know, that sort of stuff. And that plateau hasn't been reached. And it's not actually yet actually guaranteed that cryptocurrencies or crypto, you know, the blockchain is actually going to be a thing.
What?
Right.
Like, it's not a thing? I thought it was a thing.
Not a thing for me.
I mean, there's a lot of momentum. I mean, we've seen these sorts of fads come and go.
Yeah.
And it's no question that Bitcoin, you know, is right on the edge of the chasm, you know, crossing the chasm sort of a thing. But until the governments come around and start to say these are currencies and they have to be regulated and that's the next step. And until we see that sort of acceptance by the incumbent financial institutions that this is a viable form of value exchange, I don't see how these cryptocurrencies will survive. But certainly there'll be a massive shakeout. Only a few of these crypto coins will survive.
If they become legitimate, what's the point?
Well, that's the question. Like, ultimately, even the Bitcoin network today runs so slow and is so expensive that it's not a threat to Visa. Visa can process a transaction for 3 cents per transaction and charges basically, I think it's like 15 cents. And so it actually makes out pretty well. But a Bitcoin transaction costs about $15 in electricity to run through and takes roughly 4 days, 3 days, I think. Last time I checked, I've stopped bothering because I'm just tired of getting blockchain pitches. And so the problem with the blockchain is if you have a transaction today and you exchange coins, you need to wait 3 days before the network's complete, before the transaction completes.
And it's so volatile, you don't know what you paid. Three days.
If you have to wait 3 days, why don't you just mail a check?
The checks are coming back. They're coming back.
And you know, it may very well. Bookstores are coming back. Vinyl's coming back.
Vinyl is
huge. I think I'm going to invest in a check printing company. That's my next.
All the hipster kids will be writing checks with quill pens.
Exactly.
It'll be so exciting. We're going to take a little break. Get to the last, the bottom of the, at the end of this show, all the good stuff sinks to the bottom. Or maybe it's just the seeds and the stems. We're going to get to that in just a second. But first, a word from Moogsoft. You probably know about Moogsoft, Greg Farrell. It is
a little bit about them. Yes, indeed.
Algorithmic IT Ops. That's the AI in Moogsoft AI. It is a brilliant solution for people who are on pager duty. You know that you're the one who gets the incident reports. You're the one who gets all the notifications. And it's kind of like a pachinko machine in your head. It's just bing, 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 bing. And at some point when all those alerts and tickets are lighting up your monitor like a Christmas tree, you're so stressed out. You're not being productive. Nobody can analyze those alerts and respond intelligently to all those tickets. But that's where Moogsoft AI Ops comes in. It reduces the IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%, not by turning them off, but by consolidating them, correlating events into actionable work items. They call them situations. So you can say, I need to handle this. You handle the stuff that matters. It's brilliant. It works with all your IT tools. So all of those pingers can all be at work, but Moogsoft's AI Ops platform correlates them and makes it easy for you to respond to. Here's a customer testimonial, actually, from a company called HCL Technologies. They are a global IT managed service provider. That means they live in the pachinko parlor. They got multiple clients, multiple alerts coming from every possible bit of telemetry. They actually created something called the Dry Ice platform, and they use Moogsoft AI Ops as their event management layer. People love Dry Ice. It's award-winning, and it's helped their clients streamline operational workflows, reduce time in the detect to correct life cycle of incident tickets, actually by a lot, 33% reduction in the mean time to restore, just because of that. Means they can support more customers with service quality, keeping operational costs low, efficiency high. It's been really great for HCL Technologies. It could be great for you, too. With Moogsoft AI Ops, you can reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99% right now. Wouldn't that be nice? Visit Moogsoft.com to get a demo. Moogsoft, you see the logo? It's got a cow. That's the moo. I don't know what the G is. And then there's soft. Actually, I got the story from the founder. He's a big cow fan. He wanted to call it Moogsoft. He couldn't get the domain. He's also a fan of the Moog synthesizer. So I said, we'll just add a G. We'll call it Moogsoft. Well, that's Moogsoft.com, Moogsoft.com. And get a demo. We thank Moogsoft so much for their support of This Week in Tech. I've been meaning to ask you, since we've got you on, Seth, there have been just, I have to say, there have been, in the time since the last Tesla accident, there have been probably 30,000 accidents with thousands of deaths with normal gas vehicles. But because these are self-driving cars or autopilot or whatever, you're getting a lot of attention. Seems like there's been a lot of accidents lately. Uber decided to stop working on this self-driving technology entirely, I think. Is that right? What's going on?
I think you're just going to, like with any new technology, you're going to see a lot of fits and starts, stops and starts. I think we're one of the bigger EV sites and autonomous sites. So we get probably one or two tips a day from some, you know, small local paper that a Tesla was in an accident.
Right.
And there's no news there.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, when it's driving autonomously, and a lot of people say they're driving an autopilot and aren't. So sometimes you have to wait for Tesla to verify. Then it becomes kind of news if you know, somebody's been driving an autopilot and they hit that, that center divider thing and dies, sadly. That becomes, you know, a story, I guess. But I kind of feel like this is how it's going to happen. Like these things aren't just going to automatically one day be perfect. And I think that's kind of the narrative that's happening in the media right now. It's like a few people are saying that, you know, people are going to die. You know, this is not happy, but People are going to die as this technology matures. But I think this, the long-term, end result is going to be that more people will live because a lot of these accidents will be avoided. But I think the takeaway right now is that don't take your eyes off the road, like in any car.
And you mentioned the Cadillac CT6. I drove that also. That's actually a really smart, much smarter, I think, than Tesla's. It has a camera that's looking at your eyes. Mm-hmm. And if you look away, it says, wait a minute, you know, for 5 seconds, it vibrates the seat vigorously.
Yeah. It's violent. Yeah.
I don't know if you tried it because it was very hard for me to look away for the road for any length of time.
Yeah.
I finally put my hands over my eyes and peeked. And it thought I wasn't looking because I couldn't. We're driving at highway speeds. I can't, and I don't trust these things. But I think GM actually has done it pretty well. I think that Cadillac system is good.
They had a Toyota research spoke at CES and a couple other places, and he talks about a couple things. One is this lulling, you know, you get this sense of false confidence. But he also talked about how we have a much higher expectation of autonomous vehicles than we do for human-driven vehicles. So we have learned to tolerate thousands of deaths per year, or maybe millions, I'm not sure.
40,000 deaths in the U.S. yearly.
In the U.S. alone.
In the U.S. alone, more than a million globally.
Right.
A million!
And now that's unacceptable. I'm sorry, by any standard, that's unacceptable. But we have two or three horrible situations with Tesla, and suddenly that becomes a major crisis. So I agree with you, Seth, that at the end of the day, I think these cars are going to save a lot more lives, even though there's going to be some tragic situations. But I think they're going to be relatively few.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing about this is how few deaths there have been to this point. And that all of a sudden when you start to have them, that is actually a surprise and becomes news. They've actually almost done too good a job. We sort of expected there to be problems, but there wasn't in the early days.
There's always going to be nitwits who turn on the autopilot in their Tesla, then get in the passenger seat or take a nap.
Actually, it won't allow that, will it? Will it allow that? Yeah. Doesn't it require you to touch the wheel every few seconds or something?
You can confirm this, but my experience has been it gives you a few minutes before it even notifies you that your hands aren't in the wheel. You have to actually move the wheel for it to know your hands are there. That was the nice thing. Thing about the Cadillac had a capacitance system. It knew if your hands were there or not. You didn't have to jerk.
Yeah, but you don't. That without the CT6, you don't actually have to have the
your hands
on the wheel.
Yeah,
but your eyes have to be.
Yeah,
and the other thing is like they have that green light across the top of the steering wheel, which is like kind of keeps you, you know, focused on the.
It goes green when you're in autopilot. It doesn't do lane changing like the Tesla does, which is probably a good thing. It always makes me really nervous. But it does the lane keeping and it does the adaptive cruise control. And I thought it did it quite well. And I like that green light because you know if it's engaged or not. It's very clear.
Right. But to go back to like the bigger picture thing, like all of these people who have done like incredibly stupid things, like. For instance, we got a tip from somebody who had fallen asleep, like out cold, and the Tesla drove through a toll booth.
Oh, jeez.
At highway speeds, and it clipped. This is like a Model S, so a car clipped one of the curbs in the toll booth. The guy flipped over like six times. He walked away, which is like, you know, a good thing, I guess. You know, we never reported the story because we were like, you idiot. Why did you go to sleep on the freeway? You could have killed like 10 people. And, you know, clearly we weren't making friends with this possible story. But, you know, at the same time, it's just so frustrating because these people like Tesla's clearly saying, don't take your, you know, like pay attention. This is
I love the autopilot. I use it all the time. And I wish I'd had it when I commuted. Because I was at the end of the day when I was coming home, I was always get sleepy, and I was always afraid that I would nod off. And while I wouldn't recommend doing it on purpose, at least I knew that if I briefly nodded off, the car wasn't going to veer off to the side; that it was going to keep the lane. I think I would have loved to have that.
So I don't have autopilot, but I do have adaptive cruise control. And I just took a road trip from the Bay Area to Seattle. And it was a much more relaxing trip because I didn't have to worry about starting and stopping. I got in traffic. I took my, you know.
Oh, yeah, with traffic. It's great.
And I actually find that it actually helps me be less tired because I don't have to work as hard driving as I used to do. And I presume autopilot is even easier in terms of relaxing.
Yeah. So Uber did not discontinue, but they've temporarily paused all autonomous.
And they're doing it. They're going to do it in Pittsburgh. I believe they're going to restart it in Pittsburgh fairly soon.
Well, what's interesting, California has just announced that it will allow autonomous cars to pick up passengers. So this is, you know, states are sort of competing for the right to host this kind of research, which I find interesting.
Right, because Arizona already has Waymo doing autonomous driving, like on streets, public streets today.
Right.
And they'll open up in, I think, Phoenix later this year. So, you know, when people say like, I don't know, this autonomous thing, it's going to be, you know, 10, 20 years from now, it's happening right now on public streets. And this year, Google will be doing it in a major city.
Wow.
Or Waymo.
Wow. Have they figured out the pricing model yet, what people are going to pay for those
California
rides?
California requires the rides to be free, at least that's because they're testing. No. Yeah. Okay. But at some point, I'm sure. I don't know. I mean, Uber, the entire Uber business model is based on the idea that they can get drivers out of the equation. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Right.
Right.
I mean, is Google just going to show you ads the whole time you're in the car? Like, is that how the model's going to work?
Hey, why not? You're not looking at the road. You can look at the ads.
Right.
I love this headline. It's the ultimate link bait headline in the next web. Self-driving cars will kill people, and we need to accept that. It is the number one most popular article on TNW right now. So there you go.
It's a good headline. It's a link bait.
It's the ultimate link bait.
It
right?
is a link bait. Yeah.
You got,
that's right, though. It is. I mean, at the end of the day, some people will die from whatever. People will die from new medicines.
Right.
You know, modern medicine kills people, but it kills less people than if we didn't have it.
People die from wearing seatbelts. It's very rare, but there are rare cases where people die.
But they're a good thing.
Yeah, because most people are protected by them. But once in a while, something bad happens.
If you want to use Facebook or Twitter in Uganda, you have to pay a nickel.
It's quite a lot of money in Uganda.
It is, honestly. Actually, where the per capita income is $666.10.
Is that a tax?
This is a 5-cent tax, 200 shillings, levied on anyone who uses social networking or messaging apps like WhatsApp. They're calling it a social media tax. And they say the problem is it promotes gossip. The law goes into effect as of July 1st. I think
they're not wrong.
Players going to gossip. I don't think it matters if you've got WhatsApp or Facebook. Gossip happens.
I'll place a pretty substantial bet in here that this is absolutely a perfect way to graft some pretty good cash. So on one hand, you get rid of people getting social media, you lose control of external forces influencing the population.
Or charge a nickel.
Charge a nickel, you put it into a fund, and you loot that fund quite nicely, and then off you go. 5 years.
Is it a nickel per session? Government
said, if I had a nickel for every idiot, that's going to be rich.
That's a brilliant idea. Let's pass a law.
that to me looks like straight up corruption. That's the sort of tax that you can introduce. You can put it into a fund that you can do something with. End up buying a couple of chalets in France, a hotel in central London, and a couple of flats in New York, and then retire.
Mr. Greg Farrow, you're such a cynic, but that's what makes you great. Packet Pushers is at packetpushers.net. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, and he's on the Twitter at Ethereal Mind, and we love it whenever you can be on. I thank you for staying up late. What is it, 2 a.m. there?
10 past 1, but it's certainly past bedtime because you don't get to look this good by staying up to 1 o'clock every night.
Thank you, Greg. Anything you want to plug before we wrap this up?
No, but if you are into enterprise IT, you probably love some of our podcasts. Absolutely. And some of our enterprise IT coverage stuff. Because we a bunch of blogs, and we've also got a membership system we're about to launch soon. So stand by for that.
Yes. Seth, it's been really great having you on. I hope you'll come back. Seth Weintraub is editor-in-chief and founder and publisher of some of the best online publications, including 9to5 Mac, 9to5 Google, Electric, and his newest, DroneDJ.com. Anything you want to plug, Seth?
You did my plugging for me, Leo. That's my Thank
job.
You very much.
That's my job. I take it seriously. He's on the Twitter at LLSethJ. LL Cool J was taken, but LL Seth J is still available. Yes. I like it. We also thank you so much for being here, Mr. Larry Magid. He is LL Larry Magid J. No, he's not. He's at Larry Magid on the Twitter, CBS News Radio. You hear him all the time. I hear you every day on KCBS, our local CBS station.
Well, I'm glad somebody does. That's good.
ConnectSafely.org is the website. Anything you'd like to plug?
No, just come by ConnectSafely.org and, learn a little bit about internet safety and those kinds of things. And that's about it.
It's great for kids.
And listen to radio. Turn on that radio.
Listen to radio. It's listening to you.
Yeah. No, that's the other stuff.
No, that's not the radio. It's not listening to you.
That's right. That's why you should listen to it.
That's the new slogan. Listen to radio. It's not listening to you.
Exactly.
We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. Please stop by and watch us. We do it live. So you can participate in the chat room live at irc.twit.tv. The live stream is on twit.tv/live. We even invite you to join us in the studio. If you're in the Northern California area, just email tickets at twit.tv. There's no charge. We'd like to make sure we have a chair ready for you. And we had some great visitors, Cooper and Martin from Australia. We had John from Toronto, Doug from Cascade, Iowa. He's here for WWDC. And Craig from... Say again? Michigan. It's not written on my card. Thank you guys for being here. We appreciate it. If you can't be here live, you can't watch live, you can always get on demand audio and video of everything we do at Twit, including this show, at our website, twit.tv, or subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. As I said, audio and video, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Slacker, Pocket Casts, we're everywhere. Thanks for being here. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye bye. Oh, I forgot to mention kind of a big breaking story. Shoot. Microsoft has apparently acquired GitHub.
Yeah.
It's only a rumor. Yeah. It's not confirmed.
Yeah, I would have liked to talk about it, but that is a huge story.
Yeah, that would have been a good segue from Bloomberg or from the Microsoft and Google battle, because Google stopped building Google code because of GitHub.
I didn't talk about the GitHub one because it's only rumored.
Yeah.
There's no facts here.
But it would have been good to get your all's analysis. Why does Microsoft want a code sharing site? What would be the? I think they use GitHub now. I think they've settled all their stuff is on GitHub now. Is it not?
Yeah, I think it's a relationship with indie developers important.
That's a big thing for Microsoft these days, actually.
On ramp to Azure. Yeah. So
Bloomberg
the idea
reporting it as GitHub if it's true.
I think GitHub, it's true. If it's Bloomberg, I think it's true. And they say they'll announce Monday. And, I think that's true.
Because there's not going to be any news on Monday with WWDC.
Yeah,
there's not going to be any news, actually.
It's going to be such a boring
I know.
I'm disappointed.
Actually, with this backache, I'm actually debating whether I'm going to go.
It's going to be dull.
I don't know if I want to sit in a chair for 2 hours listening to Tim Cook and friends.
Yeah. It's like what Microsoft bought LinkedIn so that they could get the Office. The corporate value of the network that's inside of LinkedIn and then bind it into Microsoft Office. So you're seeing things like their Dynamics and their SharePoint. Salespeople can go out there and automatically click a button. And if you know who your customer is, the name of the person, then they can actually build a profile of that person. And the salesperson then knows a hell of a lot more about the victim. Prospect, victim. Yeah. And they're like,
Google still – what do they use for their code repository?
They used to have Google Code, but they closed that because all their folks were using GitHub.
Yeah, everybody loves GitHub. I'm not sure I love the company. There's been some less than savory stuff at the company, but I love GitHub. I do love
Google Fire Google Code Backup if that happens. and maybe Google Reader.
Well, there's other Git, right? You know, there's GitLab, there's other Git hosting, and of course you could run your own Git hosting. There's no reason why you wouldn't want to.
I think the future here is serverless. This idea that you don't actually want to run a container or a virtual machine, or you don't want to have to worry about any of that. So if you have GitHub, you could have this thing where it's like a click to deploy.
Right.
It automatically takes it out of GitHub and straight into Azure serverless, and it'll take a couple of years for that to work out.
That sounds sweet. That
guys, I'm going to say goodbye. I got to go.
All right, Larry. Yeah. It's gone on way too long. Go watch the Warriors game.
Talk all you want.
All right.
Carry
on. See ya.
So that would be my punt, is they'd look for a tie-up where you check your code into GitHub, and then you have your CI/CD, you have your Jenkins pipeline and all that sort of stuff, and then it comes straight out of the –
That's actually
the
brilliant.
Continuous, and it goes straight into production
on
there.
I like that, yeah.
And
that would be huge.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of synergies that you could probably do. I'm thinking about what if you talk to people at various of the big silicon companies, they have a whole entire teams of people just building that sort of pipeline. It goes from developer to testing to commissioning to straight into production over and over and over. And this would be a way of – and as Seth said, it would also be – bringing the developers closer to Microsoft and pulling them away from AWS.
They love that. That's why they do LSW and all that stuff. Yeah. All right, guys.
Thanks, Leo.
See you later. Have a great
night.
See
you again sometime. Cheers.
Yeah, take care.